Members and guests, we're going to call the meeting to order. We do not have a quorum yet, so we'll officially call it to order when we do, but we're going to get started in any case. I want to welcome Representative Diane Anderson to, well, not to the committee, but to the testifying table. And Okay, Representative Grunhagen moves House File 2251 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Commerce. And Representative Anderson, welcome to the committee. You can begin with your testimony.
Thank you, members. House File 2251 transfers the regulatory authority over HMOs from the Department of Health to the Department of Commerce. By doing this, the oversight of the HMOs will be in one agency. The Department of Commerce regulates all insurance carriers in Minnesota. When the HMO statutes were enacted in the 1970s, the decision was made to require them to be regulated by the Minnesota Department of Health because this was a new way of providing health coverage.
Representative Anderson, I apologize. I'm going to interrupt you briefly. We now have a quorum, and so I will call the meeting officially to order, and we will officially move, or Representative Grunhagen will officially move, that House File 2251 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Commerce. Representative Anderson, I apologize. Please continue.
So since the 1970s, the market has changed, and today the Department of Health has a memorandum of understanding with the Department of Commerce to regulate all of the financials for the Department of Health. Currently, the regulatory system is fragmented with regulators in three different agencies. This bill will achieve administrative efficiencies by locating all regulators in one place. The idea of transferring the regulatory authority of HMOs from the Commissioner of Health to the Commissioner of Commerce has been around for 10 to 15 years. Passage of this bill will also help consumers by locating the regulator in one place, not multiple places. Right now, consumers have to figure out which agency to contact when they have a problem. It makes sense to simplify the regulatory structure by locating it in a single state agency. That's all I have, Mr. Chairman.
Very good. Thank you, Representative Anderson. You have testifiers?
She's just basically here for questions. So.
Okay, very good. Members, questions to the bill? I'm sorry. Okay, we do have a testifier, but in the meantime, is Ms. Brace here? Representative Huntley has a question. Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair and Ms. Anderson, why don't we move all the regulations to the Department of Health, since this has to do with the health insurance, and which is entirely different than automobile insurance. It seems to me the health department is more qualified to certainly regulate health insurance and the impact that health has on the consumers of the state. So why don't we move all the regulation from out of the Commerce Department as far as health insurance is concerned to the Department of Health?
Actually, I'll weigh in on that, Representative Huntley, because actually your example works the other way. If automobile insurance, we'd move auto insurance to public safety if we wanted to do that. It's actually in Commerce, which underscores the reason why health insurance is in Commerce as well. But Representative Anderson.
Would you like to tell me? Sure. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Catherine Committed. I'm here from the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. And in response to Representative Huntley's question, it is a good question. However, most of the regulation takes place at the Department of Commerce currently. Certainly that could be an option if you wanted to move all of those people over from the Department of Commerce over to the Department of Health, but I do believe that the people at the Department of Commerce have multiple responsibilities for financial oversight in addition to the health plans, but for a variety of other insurance products.
Representative Huntley. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question for either Representative Anderson or the testifier. So will this, you know, we've had a little controversy, I don't know if you're aware, on with the HMOs and the PMAP program a little bit, but will this reduce the reports and bring more clarity to the issue by having it in one department? I guess that's my question.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Grunhagen, no. They're still going to be subject to the same laws, and the rules that are currently imposed are all going to be the same. We're not changing any of that. This is just simply going to locate everybody in one agency, so you're not going to have maybe one agency thinking they're doing something when the other one isn't. So it's going to be a better way to communicate to make sure that oversight is being done.
Okay, other questions, members? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Anderson. So is it contemplated then that are you thinking that people would literally move from one location to the other, people that would be regulating? That's the first question that I have. And if so, is there a fiscal note for this bill?
Mr. Chairman, yes.
Representative Anderson.
This bill, we're not having any costs involved. We're not getting rid of any current employees. So basically what's going to be happening is the employees at the Department of Health, we're anticipating, well, most of them will be moving over to the Department of Commerce.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Anderson, if people are going to actually be moving from one location to another, isn't there a fiscal note? I mean, you can't do that for nothing.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Liebling, yes, normally that would be the case. However, in this case, the employees at the Department of Health would just move up a floor or two floors up to the fifth floor of the Golden Rule building, which is where the regulation takes place at the Department of Commerce. They're co-located in that same building.
I would mention, too, this, we're obviously a policy committee, Representative Liebling, and certainly questions about finance are appropriate, but probably better saved for our finance committee discussion.
Well,
Representative
Chair,
Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are we going to have testifiers from the agencies involved?
I believe the agency is present. Does anybody want to testify on it from the Department of Health or the Department of Commerce or both? I think they're making their way to the testifying table. Representative Liebling. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Jim Koppel. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Health. I would be happy to answer any questions. What we are currently going through, and I stopped by and visited with Representative Anderson yesterday, is a process where we are talking with the Department of Commerce in trying to sort out some of these issues. We do feel, by function, there are consolidations to be made, for instance, in terms of financial viability. Certainly, the Department of Commerce has credentials and the expertise, and we currently contract with them for that work with us, and you could see a natural fit there. On the other hand, we look at network viability to make sure there are providers that are capable of providing the services. We look at health plans to see if they're producing health, which is what the Department of Health is all about. So in some ways, it's I don't want to say it's complicated because it isn't, but it's more by function than you could just throw a blanket over it and say, well, it could all go one place. So we would like to, regardless of what actions you take today, we would like to continue the conversation because we are in these conversations and we might have some additional information that we'd like to pass along, a different way to look at it. So that was basically what I wanted to convey today.
Thank you, Mr. Koppel. It's an intriguing idea. I like the fact that you brought this bill forward, Representative Anderson. The one question I would ask you is maybe along the lines of the conversation that Representative Huntley and I just had a moment ago. If, for example, you took the same philosophy with perhaps auto insurance, you'd be looking at maybe public safety and so on and so forth. Obviously, it's health insurance, but at the end of the day, there's probably a commerce function and a health function. Can you help enlighten me on that?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I think it's kind of along the lines of what we are thinking here, and that is, I'm going to oversimplify, and I'm not an expert, so I apologize in advance. I'm not trying to be, in insurance, you are interested in making sure the company's viable financially. You want to be able to audit and make sure that the risk is appropriate and all of those things. That's insurance, traditional insurance. And then also at the same time, you want to make sure for what the benefits you are offering, you want to make sure that they have a network of providers that would be able to deliver that product. Which is different than the financial side. And you also want to make sure that as a result, the consumers in their coverage achieve the health status that we want for them. And that's part of the quality measurements that we do currently and are working on, as well as best practices and other quality indicators. So you are looking at two different types of activities. And they both kind of go with the psyche of each of the departments or the missions of each of those departments. So to move all of it into one department, I think you're kind of isolating bits and pieces within a department that might have an expertise in financial viability, and then you're going to put in quality or health indicators or something else in there that's not really in their core. And so that's why I was thinking more along the lines of function as opposed to just wholesale change. Mm-hmm.
I see we have someone from Commerce here as well. Would you like to offer some comment on behalf of the department?
I think.
Or not? John, I don't want to put you on the spot if you don't want to be. But
just for questions, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Liebling, did you have other questions? I apologize.
Well, no, Mr. Chair, thank you very much. You know, I think this is it's interesting. We could have an interesting philosophical discussion here about what is the nature of the beast, okay? You know, are these just insurance companies? And I think what we've just heard the deputy commissioner explain is that they're not. And frankly, if all they are is insurance companies, my question would be, why do we need them? Because we don't need them to insure for us. In fact, we kind of insure them by, up until now, always making sure that they remain whole if they lose money on our program. So, you know, it's really a curious thing. I'm assuming that the health plans, maybe I shouldn't assume, Representative Anderson, are the plans in favor of this move? Is that what I'm understanding here, that they're asking for this, or what's their position?
Ms. Webb?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Liebling, this came out of from the summer when we had different stakeholder meetings, and it did not come from the health plans themselves. It came from other stakeholders that attended these meetings.
And Representative Liebling, Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, we love all our regulators equally.
Ooh,
so
good
answer. We're not picking one over another, but since Representative Anderson brought this bill forward, we thought we would just provide assistance on any of these questions.
Well,
Representative Liebling.
Mr. Chair, well, thank you. That's why they pay you the big money, because you can do that. That's very good. But, I think it does lead us. I would say that perhaps this bill is a little premature, because we're going to be having a lot of discussions about transparency and about the role of the HMOs. And it seems to me that, in line with what Mr. Koppel just said, that there may be different pieces that need to go different places, but I certainly don't see the HMOs as just insurance companies. And as I say, if they are, in fact, if you think about it, the whole notion of health insurance is kind of an odd one, because they're really not, it's not like car insurance or any kind of insurance where you're kind of pooling resources against a rare risk. That's not what health insurance is, because we all need it. If not for preventative, then at some time we're all going to need health care. And so really the idea that we even fit that into the health insurance model is kind of an odd thing to begin with. But then for us to take HMOs and just say these are just so much health, so much just insurance, that we need to put them in the Commerce Department and get rid of the Health Department's oversight responsibility. I'm not ready for that one. So thanks, Mr. Chair.
Perhaps, Representative Liebling, though, you would be ready to move the minutes from our February 22nd meeting. Would you be so inclined? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. I wanted to make sure we got that taken care of. Representative Liebling, are you done?
Yes.
Okay, good. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If the was it assistant or associate commissioner could return to the table. I had a couple of quick questions. The first one being, does the Department of Health regulate anything in auto insurance?
Mr. Chairman, no. Representative Quam, no, we do not.
Representative Quam. Mr. Chair, because I do know some people that have had health care paid for by auto insurance, and, you know, with accidents and et cetera. And then if I can ask another question.
Certainly.
Deputy Commissioner or Assistant Commissioner, what, you know, in workman's comp, if you're hurt on the job, I happen to have a hand that got trapped between a couple of cylinders in a job and went to, and that was paid by workman's comp. Does the Department of Health regulate workman's comp insurance?
Mr. Koppel.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Quam, as far as I know, we don't have anything to do with that either.
Representative Quam.
Mr. Chair, thank you. So it appears as if other insurances that do pay for medical care aren't in, you know, the Department of Health. Does someone know, are both of those underneath the Department of Commerce, Mr. Chair?
I don't know if somebody wants to comment on behalf of Commerce. I believe they are, but Mr. Reich is making his way to the testifying table. Mr. Reich, welcome to the committee. For the record, please state your name and who you represent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John Reich from the Department of Commerce. Representative Quam, we regulate auto insurance policies, so they are filed with the department and approved by the department. We also take calls related to insurance from the public, so so we're responsive with respect to auto insurance policies. With respect to work comp, we administer what's called the assigned risk pool, which is the work comp insurer of last resort. I'm not 100% certain, but the fee schedules and other things for work comp is actually at the Department of Labor and Industry, as I understand it, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Quam.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Due to that additional information, I don't see anything inconsistent with, this bill, and I guess I support it. Thank you.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I have just a couple of questions for the author, please. Representative Anderson, the Deputy Commissioner from Health talked about their role in assuring network adequacy and also looking at the health of the people being served in the health plans, and I'm wondering if those are goals that you share regardless of this piece of legislation.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, yes. We're not trying to change anything by making sure some regulations are not being done or anything by making this change. We want to make sure that all the regulatory stuff that's being done right now will still continue to be done. We're not trying to get rid of any of that at all.
And Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson. So if we're not going to try and change the basic frame, and I share that, I don't think that we should, then how do you envision how the Department of Commerce would achieve those goals under this piece of legislation?
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chairman, do you have insight more as to what's happened in the past?
And Mr. Chair, we could maybe ask the Department of Commerce as well if, or maybe the answer is we don't know yet and we have to figure that out.
The question is, what's my opinion? I mean, obviously, department functions can be shared, and I expect that the Department of Health right now in its management of HMOs is working with the Department of Commerce on aspects of HMOs. This is an interesting discussion, actually. Does the Department of Commerce want to comment on that? Representative Murphy, were you asking them to comment on it?
Mr. Chairman, this bill is going to the Department of Commerce, so we will be having
well, it's going to the Commerce
I mean, the Commerce Correct. Committee, so we can have those issues about the Commerce and the Commerce Committee as well.
And, Mr. Chair, I think my point really is that currently, you know, under the current law and the way this work is organized, there is a relationship between commerce and health. And I would imagine in the future there will be a relationship between commerce and health in the oversight of HMOs in Minnesota. So while I understand we're hearing the bill today, I'm not exactly sure why we need to do it. But that's just my point. Thank you.
Twyla Brace is here as a testifier, Ms. Brace. And I would ask anybody else wanting to testify for or against this bill if you could maybe start kind of queuing up towards the testifying table so we can keep the hearing moving. Ms. Brace, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record, who you represent, and then proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Twyla Brace. I'm president of Citizens Council for Health Freedom, and I just have the smallest little comment about this. And we have always been supportive of putting the health plans into the Department of Commerce because, obviously, it's all insurance. The only thing I just want you to think about, and we're not actually opposing the bill, but I just want you to think about the fact that Commerce is the one that's going to run everything under the Federal Health Care Reform Law, and it's all managed care. And so I just want you to think as you are moving in this direction that this is... This is one piece of the puzzle. So, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Brace. Members, any questions? Other testifiers, anybody wanting to testify for or against this bill? For or against this bill? Members, additional questions? Representative Liebling.
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to request a roll call on this.
A roll call has been requested. And seeing no other conversation, Representative Grinhagen renews his motion that Representative Anderson's House File 2251 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Department of Commerce. The clerk will take the roll on the bill.
Dat Walt.
Aye.
Mack.
Aye.
Abler.
Aye.
Allen.
No.
Barrett.
Aye.
Benson.
Aye.
Franzen.
Aye.
Fritz?
No.
Grunhagen?
Yes.
Osh?
No.
Huntley?
No.
Kiffmeyer?
Aye.
Liebling?
No.
Lohmer?
Aye.
McDonald?
Aye.
McElpatrick?
Aye.
Moran?
No.
Murphy?
No.
Norton?
No.
Peterson? Quam?
C.
There being 12 ayes and 8 nays, the motion prevails, and your bill, House File 2251, is passed out of this committee and re-referred to the Committee on Commerce. Representative Anderson, thank you.
Thank you, members. Thank you for all your help. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I will move that House File 1986 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance.
Okay, members, Chair Gottwalt is moving his bill, and we don't have any author's amendment. Okay, Representative Gottwalt, do you want to present your author's amendment first?
I do. Members, this is a technical amendment, the A1 amendment on page 2, line 32. We are striking paragraph B and inserting this paragraph. It's a technical amendment, and I would encourage your support.
Members, any questions on the A1 amendment? Seeing no questions, all those in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Gottwalt, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, House File 1986 expands on a program that was enacted into law this past year. It becomes functional on July 1 of this summer. The Healthy Minnesota Contribution Program takes a portion of the adults without children under the Minnesota Care Program and moves them into a new program, which will provide them a subsidy for private health insurance premium payment. What the House file does in essence is expands the number of people who are eligible for this particular program. We had gone to 200% of federal poverty guideline. This takes this down to 150% of federal poverty guideline, which for an adult, and we're talking about the July 1, 2012, is roughly $17,000 for an individual. People on Minnesota Care, as you know, already pay a premium, so they will have the amount they currently pay for that, if they're eligible for the program, along with the subsidy to go to market for a private individual insurance policy, which then, of course, is portable for them. As long as they pay the premiums, they can never be kicked off of that coverage. That stands in contrast to the path we were going on with Minnesota Care, which was basically unsustainable. The dollars were piling up, and the funding was not. And so this is a different path. We had these discussions quite a bit over the last couple of years. But basically what this bill does is expand the eligibility for this particular program down to 150% of federal poverty guideline. With that, Madam Chair, I'll take questions.
Representative Huntley.
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Gottwalt, we do not have a fiscal note with this, although I know there is a fiscal note. And I understand from that fiscal note that about 4,000 people will lose health insurance because of this amendment. Is that correct? And why don't we have a fiscal note?
Representative Gottwalt.
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Huntley, I'll answer your first question, or your second question first. You, having been a committee chair, know that this isn't a finance committee, so that's why we don't have a fiscal note. The fiscal note indicates $6 million in the first year and substantial savings in the out years. I don't have it in front of me either, but I do know that's the initial upfront cost. And it's similar to the cost that was for the original bill, mainly because of a shift in the funding. It's a timing issue more than anything else, but it does indicate $6 million in the first year. So that's the answer to the first question. The second question about 4,000 people being kicked off of coverage is frankly outrageous. Fiscal notes, we had the same argument on the fiscal note last time around too. There are assumptions that whenever you are changing public programs, the assumption the department makes is that simply by the complexity of moving a person from one arrangement to another, that some will simply choose not to do that. I have argued back to the department, and they didn't disagree with me, that these people, by being on Minnesota Care and paying their own premium, they're already paying something towards their own health care coverage, are probably fairly personally invested in maintaining their own health care coverage and are less likely to disenroll from the program. So I would disagree with that that number, Representative Huntley, but we can have that debate if you want.
Representative Huntley.
Madam Chair, could we have somebody from the Department of Human Services give us a number of people in the fiscal note that would lose insurance?
Madam Chair, I would ask, this is a policy committee, and we do not have the fiscal note in front of us, and we are not here to talk about the fiscal note.
Well,
Representative,
we're here to talk about policy.
Madam Chair, the policy is, are 4,000 people going to lose health insurance? So I think that is a policy issue, and I think we ought to address it today. And I think we ought to have the experts come down and tell me if I'm right or wrong.
Is there anyone here from the department who would like to speak to, not necessarily the fiscal note and the dollar amount, but to what Representative Huntley is asking about? Anyone from the department? I am not seeing anyone.
Here they go.
Oh. Mr. Lights is approaching the table. If you
could introduce yourself and who you represent.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Scott Leitz, Assistant Commissioner of the Department of Human Services. Madam Chair, could I ask Representative Huntley to just repeat the question, please?
Representative Huntley.
Madam Chair and Commissioner Leitz, I have seen a fiscal note, and I'm trying to remember it. I saw it very briefly on Representative Gottwald's bill that shows a significant number of people losing health insurance. And what I'm trying to do is find out if that is correct and how many people would lose health insurance if we pass this bill.
Mr. Leitz.
Madam Chair and Representative Huntley, I may need to seek a little bit of clarification from some staff on this. We may need a few minutes to get that information. I think what you might be referring to is relative to the current MinnesotaCare program. If we were to move to a defined contribution program at a lower level, would the average monthly enrollment differ between those two programs? And I think the answer is that part of the fiscal note assumes that there would be a smaller enrollment under the defined contribution approach than under current MinnesotaCare. I believe that's what the fiscal note currently assumes. We'll work to get clarification on that pretty rapidly, though.
Representative Gottwald.
If I could add, Madam Chair, and Representative Huntley, maybe you can help me with what you're thinking along these lines, and maybe Mr. Leitz could clarify as well. The estimated total population of the Healthy Minnesota Contribution Program as it's currently, not even with the expansion, the total number of people that it would impact on MinnesotaCare is 4,000 people. So the argument now is that by moving down to 150%, we're going to lose 4,000 people, and then the assumption, of course, would be there would be additional people enrolled. So I'm finding it hard to believe that by making this adjustment, you're going to actually put more people off of the program than currently are even eligible for the program.
Representative Huntley.
Well, Madam Chair, and again, maybe I'm not understanding this right, but I have the fiscal note now, and on page 7, it says net cost of program change. And there is dollar savings in the long run, but it also says enrollment change, 10-month average in fiscal year 13, and it looks to me like about 3,800 people losing health insurance because the number, the enrollment change is a minus 3,881.
There's a list.
Representative Gottwald.
I can't comment further than what's been described. I think there is an issue about how the numbers are stacking up. I think, Representative Huntley, you've done this before. The assumption is you're going to kick 4,000 people off of coverage. I think there's more to these numbers than that, but I don't know that the department's prepared to speak to that at this point.
Mr. Leitz.
Madam Chair, Representative Huntley, no, I think you've captured, I think, the way the fiscal note was done reasonably accurately, and I was just having a sidebar with Representative Gottwald to explain, I think, what was done in the fiscal note. The assumption in the fiscal note is that the expected average participation in the defined contribution of the Healthy Minnesota benefit set would be about 70% of what the expected enrollment under the current MinnesotaCare program would be.
So,
Representative Huntley.
That means there will be a reduction in the number of people that have health insurance.
Okay, Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Just a follow-up comment, a couple comments. First one is, I haven't seen the fiscal note, but just from the comments that were made, wouldn't the minus 3,800 means they are re-enrolled in the private market and out of the government program? I mean, that's just a conclusion based on the comments across the table here. In other words, they're moving from a government program to the private market, so the minus 3,800 would be the assumption that they're leaving the government program, not that they wouldn't be insured.
Representative Gottwald.
Madam Chair, Representative Grunhagen and Representative Huntley, I think that is accurate as we're looking at this. What we're talking about is the number of people who come off of a government program, not who lose coverage. And it's, in fact, a total for the Minnesota, the Healthy Minnesota Contribution Program, not just the expansion. So Representative Huntley's assertion that by passing this bill you throw 4,000 people off of coverage is inaccurate. By passing this bill, you add to a bill that was passed last year, and 4,000 people come off of government programs, not off of health care coverage. That's the correct way to read this, as I understand. Is that correct, Mr. Lights?
Mr. Lights.
Madam Chair and Madam Chair, I think the way that one would read the fiscal note is the following. That the average monthly enrollment in Minnesota Care, using a 10-month average for fiscal year 13, I'll just use 1 year as an example, is about 11,423 of the people who would fit this income and eligibility category. So it would be between 150% and 200% of poverty for adults without children. That would be the decline in the Minnesota Care traditional enrollment. And then there would be a take-up on the other side of that of about 70% of that number of people who would enroll in private sector coverage. So you would, under the Healthy Contribution Program, so you would have a take-up of about a little bit less than 8,000 people of the 11,000 who dropped out of the original Minnesota Care. About 8,000 of those would come on to the program here.
And if I could, Madam Chair, Mr. Wright, if I could ask you while you're here at the testifying table, what is the assumption? Why is there an assumption that 30% are not going to take this on?
Mr. Light.
Madam Chair, Representative Gottwalt, I don't believe Mr. Hoffman's in the room right now. I think the difference is on the fiscal note assumptions relates mainly to the differences in the benefit and likely the differences in cost sharing that exist. I don't know all the assumptions behind the fiscal note as it stands, but I believe it relates to those two pieces. I believe last year's fiscal note, if I recall correctly, because it was at a slightly higher income level, assumed about an 85% take-up. I think the difference here is that as we slide down in income levels, there was an assumption made in the fiscal note that the take-up would be somewhat smaller simply because we're moving down the income scale a little bit relative to what it was last year.
Madam Chair, I'll just mention that last year Mr. Hoffman, who was referenced here, specifically stated that in the fiscal note the reasoning was they expected a lot of these people simply would not take the trouble to transition from one program to another. And
members, most of us do not have the fiscal note in front of us, and just want to remind you that this will be discussed at length as this goes on to the Health and Human Services Finance Committee. Representative Grunigan, do you have a follow-up?
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Gottwald, wouldn't it be true also that by moving these people to an individual policy, the reimbursement rate would be higher for the doctors and hospitals off a private sector plan?
Representative Gottwald.
Madam Chair, that is one of the benefits of this program. We have been balancing public programs in the state of Minnesota on the backs of providers and hospitals for quite a while and underpaying them for Medicaid, for Minnesota Care. In fact, this moves them to a commercial product, which tends to pay much better than our public programs. So that is true. And by the way, I would mention that gets that access as well. People walking in with a commercial coverage product are accepted more readily than some, we've heard many providers saying they're no longer going to be accepting people on public programs because they simply cannot afford the kind of under-reimbursement that's happening under current public programs.
Representative Grunhagen.
Yeah, just a follow-up comment. Representative Gottwald covered part of it, but I think it's important to understand for the public and us in general that government programs reimburse at a rate that actually loses money for the doctors and hospitals and at a lower rate than the private sector. To the degree that we can shift people on public programs over to the private sector with a subsidy is beneficial for all of us. It'll save money, give higher reimbursements to the doctor and hospital, and reduce the amount of pressure for cost shifting to the private sector in the healthcare industry. And so I applaud Representative Gottwald for bringing this forward. I think we should continue looking at it and expanding it down the road because it helps solve the problem in a way that we can still help the people in need in a fiscally responsible way rather than underpaying the providers who then lose money on every deal and try and make it up in volume. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Grunhagen. Members, we have Abler, Kiffmeyer, Liebling, Moran, Hosh, Murphy, and Allen on the list. Representative Abler.
Madam Chair, I'll be brief. I'm personally uncomfortable with having people not choose to take this up, and I think it is a matter to work along the way. I support the proposal. I think if we don't find ways to do our business and get people a better product, we're going to be sorry in the long run. And the hospital coverage on Minnesota Care is only $9,000, which includes a $1,000 deductible, and it pays up to 10. So they're really not protected. And so thinking this is secure coverage is not wise. But Representative Huntley and others, maybe we can find a way to help the bill to be crafted so that the uptake is higher, so people realize the value of having permanent good coverage. I'm willing to work on that. So good luck along the way.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I believe the same thing. I know that we're going to see this again in the Finance Committee, and Representative Gutwalt will continue to work with others as well. And with that, I'm ready to vote. Thank you.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a few questions for Representative Gutwalt. Representative Gutwalt, the initial pilot, is, as you said, is set to begin on July 1st, and yet before that even goes into effect, before we see what the effect is going to be, you're expanding the eligibility. And I'm wondering why you wouldn't want to wait, because the things that you're saying, they're kind of, some of them are sort of empirical questions, right? We want to see, that's why you have a pilot. You want to see what the effect is. So I'm wondering why you're kind of jumping the gun here and not waiting to get any data back.
Representative Gutwalt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And it's a good question, Representative Liebling. And I know we've all wrestled with how far down do you go in the federal poverty guidelines before you reach people who do not function well with traditional health insurance products, frankly, and are not well served by them. Some people in this legislature have recommended that we use this proposal and get everybody. I have not been one of them. I think that there is a point at which you get too low and you start impacting people who do not deal well with traditional insurance, where they really need a public program. So I'm recognizing that. I think part of the reason I'm bringing it now before we launch the other is that I certainly thought it was a good idea then. I think it's a good idea now. I was a little disappointed when I saw the numbers in the original pilot. I originally presented the bill. Some people were very concerned about the numbers, and we all kind of came to realize that the pilot was very small. It's a relatively small number of people, about 4,000 lives in this pilot. I thought we could do a little bit larger one. Keep in mind we have 800,000 people on public programs in the state of Minnesota. And of that, right now, the program only covers 4,000, and we'd like to expand it just a little bit more. I think the pilot would be a little bit more robust, and we might actually have a better sampling at that point. But in answer to your question, that's why I decided to bring it forward. I think it's a good idea. I think it can apply down to 150%.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Representative Gutwalt, I think that's why we have pilots, though, so we can see how they roll out before we expand them, because, you know, I don't think anybody would disagree that that doing this involves some big changes for the people on the programs. You know, we actually did this in the last budget over moving some people into HMOs that were on fee-for-service, and I heard from some of those people that mainly they're people with mental illness, and they're, you know, it's a big change, and it's quite disturbing for them, and there are all kinds of issues. Can they still get the same medication? Can they still go to the same providers? There are a lot of things happen to people, especially people who have real issues, health issues, when you do this sort of big changes. So I have that concern. I'm also concerned about what happens on these insurance products that people might be able to buy with their copays and deductibles, you know, the cost-sharing part of it. We heard in the last committee about how important it is not to put barriers in the way of prenatal care, for example. Now, I don't know on the private insurance or what might get charged or not charged in terms of cost sharing for that, but I just think that we're making a big leap here, and I think it would just be the prudent to allow the pilot to work before we start expanding it. And the other piece, too, that I just want to mention, you mentioned in your opening about
how Minnesota Care is having all these problems with that. Well, we know that the Affordable Care Act is going to pick up a lot of the people on Minnesota Care. So it's all going to change anyway. And we also know that, and there's a bill that's very popular among lots of people on both sides of the aisle to get rid of the provider tax as that all happens. So this is all moving forward anyway. I'm just very uncomfortable with this. And Madam Chair, I also want to, while I have the floor, I also do want to request a roll call on this bill. So if
Representative Liebling has requested a roll call. There will be a roll call on this bill. Any further questions, Representative Liebling?
Well, Madam Chair, I just, if Representative Gottwald knows the answer about the prenatal care issue, what's likely to happen as these lower-income people go and find these products in the commercial market, I'd be curious to know.
Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Liebling, thanks for the question. I think this goes to some misunderstandings people have about health insurance in general versus public programs. As Representative Abler alerted to earlier, Minnesota Care only provides inpatient coverage up to $10,000. You can blow through an inpatient hospitalization, $10,000 inpatient like that, and then you're left not covered under our public program. Okay, so that's a criticism of the Minnesota Care program. Over on the private insurance side, a lot of people get concerned about deductibles and how you pay for that portion that is your responsibility. There are many ways you can do that, but it is a concern. I acknowledge that's a legitimate concern. But when it comes to preventive care, there are I don't believe there are any policies in the state sold in the individual market that do not provide dollar one coverage for preventive care, including prenatal care and well infant care. Now, Representative Huntley is shaking his head. If he can point me to a product that does not cover that, I'll accept that answer. But the truth is, if you look at the individual marketplace, the kind of coverages you can purchase there actually end up doing a much better job for you on the high end and puts you in control of the spending on the low end. So, I mean, there are arguments on both sides with that regard, but I would tell you that somebody taking this subsidy and going out on the market and buying an individual policy is going to end up with prenatal care. And if Representative Huntley has something else to contribute to that, I'd be glad to hear it.
Representative Huntley, to this point.
There are individual policies for sale in the Minnesota that do not cover prenatal coverage. And if you would like to ask somebody from one of the insurance companies to come down, I'm sure they would say that. And I also believe, but I'm not absolutely certain, that companies that have less than 15 employees also do not have to cover prenatal. But I might be wrong on that. But the individual one, I'm pretty sure of.
I don't know if there's anybody here from Commerce who wants to comment on that, but I would also suggest that this also allows for a great deal of choice. Instead of having one-size-fits-all policy called Minnesota Care that may or may not meet your needs, you can choose a policy. And you can choose a policy that has prenatal care coverage, if that's the case. But is there anybody from Commerce who can clarify that? John?
Please. Please introduce yourself and who you represent.
Madam Chair, John Reich, Department of Commerce. I don't know the answer. I'd have to contact the committee on that. So I'd have to consult with the experts at the department and get back to you on that.
Okay, thank you. Unless there's anyone else who wants to speak to that, we'll move on to our other folks with questions and can possibly circle back to this with more information if that comes forward. Representative Moran.
I pass, Madam Chair.
Okay, Representative Hosh. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So my comment is really built on the comments that Representative Grunhagen was making about the public program versus the commercial program. And in it, I think, is teed up this choice, this trade-off between adequate coverage for Minnesotans, middle class, at the low end of middle class Minnesota, and the 30% of people who fall off of this healthy contribution program, the trade-off between that choice and provider payment, right? And that just, to me, seems like it should be a false choice for us, and that we should be smart enough to figure out how to make sure working and middle-class Minnesotans have access to adequate coverage that pays providers a rate that we think is adequate. What they charge and what we think is adequate might be different, and we need, you know, we're not that sharp about that part. I don't really know what the answer is, but I don't know that we should choose between we'll pay the providers more, but the cost of that is 30% of the people in Minnesota care will fall out of the program. That just, and I bet you don't think that's right either. So, and then just one more point to Representative Gottwald. We have been looking at this for years. You've been working on this for years. And as we are reaching down into the lower levels of income, I can see where this is dovetailing in with the discussion that we need to have about a health insurance exchange, which I know for some people is a topic that doesn't want to be discussed, but I'm not comfortable about moving forward with this proposal until we have that discussion as well, so we can understand how they fit together or how they will fit together into the future. So I know you have work to do on this, and I appreciate that, but at some point we're going to have that discussion as well about an insurance exchange in Minnesota and how these two things are alike or different. Thank you.
Representative Gottwald.
Madam Chair, just real briefly to that, I have no problem broaching that topic. I do not share the confidence that I've heard from you and Representative Liebling about the future of that program, nor its sustainability. I think there are many promises being made with money we don't have, and I get very concerned about the promises being made from Washington about how they're going to cover all kinds of people here in Minnesota and whether or not that's actually going to happen. So I don't share your confidence that's going to happen. I'm more than happy to talk about it, but I believe more firmly that we have the tools at our disposal here in Minnesota to move us forward and to do a good job for the people of our state. And I'd like to see us make those kinds of decisions now rather than waiting for the federal government to make those decisions.
Representative Murphy.
And thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Gottwald. Of course, you know that I think that we should build a Minnesota exchange. We've talked about this together. So I'm not waiting for the federal government to tell us what kind of exchange we should have in Minnesota. Instead, I'm arguing that we should do the work here. And I think we have a lot of similarity in our perspective on that.
We have two more folks with questions, and then we're going to move to our, we do have a couple of testifiers, so if those testifiers want to approach the table, want to speak to this. Representative Allen.
Thank you, Chair. My comment is, first, I hear you saying on the other side of the aisle that this will enhance, you want to enhance privatization. That's a word, I don't know if anybody's mentioned that. Privatization, I mean, that's the most controversial part here and something that we're rushing into here in an area where you're dealing with a population that is extremely vulnerable, and we're doing a pilot project and we're, you know, privatizing an area. In a perfect world, yes, privatization may or may not improve healthcare, improve the product, improve delivery. In a perfect world, you know, those are sound arguments. Yes, privatization possibly could do that in some areas, possibly. But it's always, I think the majority of people would see it as it's appalling when you're talking about a vulnerable, when you're talking about Social Security with seniors, this is the same thing. You're talking about privatization of healthcare with a very vulnerable population. It doesn't work. There are so many different reasons why low-income people cannot participate in the private health insurance market. And I would encourage you to talk to some of the people that, And I don't think we can really experiment with the population unless we know how people in this bracket, this income bracket, actually live. What is their? How do they function day to day? How would they afford private health insurance? Would they even? And so it's disturbing to me. That's all I have to say. Thank you,
Representative Gottwald.
Madam Chair, just briefly, Representative Allen, I know you weren't around for the initial discussions of this bill, but this program, Minnesota Care, is targeted at who we would call the working poor. These people primarily do not have coverage because they cannot afford it, not because they're incapable of getting it or making a decision about it. I differentiate this from the population that Representative Murphy and Representative Dean worked on, the general assistance medical care population, which is, in fact, very vulnerable, does not function well in a traditional insurance market. But these people do not have coverage primarily because they cannot afford it. And so this bill takes us in the direction of saying the state's role will be to help you afford it. It removes the one barrier that's standing between you and insurance. And we can debate whether or not they ought to have the one-size-fits-all Minnesota Care program given to them under the current program, or whether we give them the choice of what's available to everybody else who can afford insurance coverage. And I think that's the discussion or the dialogue. But I don't think even down to this level we're putting people who are incapable of making their own care decisions at risk. If it were, I would have the same concern. But I respect your comments. And just wanted to share that because that's been kind of the history of the discussion on this bill.
Representative Allen.
Yeah, I appreciate that response. But it, to me, it's not about whether somebody's incapable. The working poor, they're poor. And so it's not about incapable or... It is about economic reality. It is about our current economic situation, our foreclosures, the cost of health care. The people that are really, I would imagine that people that are incapable of making that decision, the health care will be provided for them. But when we're talking about, I understand we're talking about working poor.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, just a couple of comments. I do believe that privatizing as many of the people on government programs as possible with a government subsidy to help them purchase the individual insurance is the way to go. With a population that, rather than building dependency, I think we treat them responsibly. And I think your bill takes us in that direction because I think they want to be responsible rather than dependent on government. And I respectfully disagree with some of the other conclusions that were just voiced here, but I'm open to discussing it after the committee meeting. But as far as deductibles and co-pays, let me just say this. One of the greatest problems we've had, based on the doctors and hospital administrators I've talked to over the years, and I've dealt with this, and even the insurance industry, I've dealt with it over 30-some years, is overutilization. And that means that when people perceive something to be free, you get overutilization. And that's what... drives up a lot of cost in our healthcare system. By having deductibles and copay, you promote responsible healthcare choices rather than just go to the doctor because it's covered anyway. And the illustration I'll give you, and even in the, we can't deal with that, even in the Medicare area, federally, copays and deductibles would produce lower utilization and more responsible healthcare consumption. I mean, think about this. What if we had food insurance? Everybody go to the grocery store and just get as much free food as they want. Well, pretty soon we'd have shortages of food. Pretty soon you'd have to have a government employee go along and help you pick the food out that you need. And that's called an HMO or a government bureaucrat today. So I see Representative Gottwald's bill taking us in a very positive direction. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. We are going to, at this point, move to our testifiers, and then we'll come back for further questions and comments by members. Ms. Abderholden, if you could introduce yourself and who you represent for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. I do want to thank Representative Gottwald, who worked closely with me last year as I continually testified against the bill actually include coverage for mental health and substance abuse, which I really did appreciate because so many single policies didn't cover it. I will just point out that the type of mental health benefits are still different than what is in Minnesota Care because both medical assistance and Minnesota Care cover the model mental health benefit set, which includes children's therapeutic services and supports, adult rehab mental health services, and intensive residential services. Some people who obviously have a pre-existing condition won't be able to purchase on the open market, and so they will go to the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association, which also has extremely high deductibles. Our largest concern is with the high deductibles. I wasn't able to reproduce what I did last year is we actually went to healthcare.gov and pulled out every policy that you would be able to afford with the subsidy. And you can see you can afford a lot of them. The problem is that most of the deductibles were between $1,000 and $4,000, which if you're making $16,000, $17,000, $18,000, $19,000, $20,000 a year is pretty substantial if you're a family of one or a family of two. A family of two, 150% of poverty is $22,065. So if you have a $4,000 deductible, that's going to be tough. There's been a lot of research that's been done about the impact of high deductibles. While it might help if you are higher income in terms of, you know, choosing your health care wisely, what the studies have shown is that for people who are low income, what they end up doing is actually not accessing care at all. Some of the policies say you can have three visits and then you have to spend up to your deductible, and so people might go to three visits during the year and then not go for anything else. One of the studies found that 38% of adults with deductibles of only $1,000 or more reported at least one of four cost-related access problems: not filling a prescription, not getting medical specialist care, skipping a recommended test or follow-up, or having a medical problem but not visiting a doctor or clinic. They also found that 54% of people with the same deductible or more reported difficulties paying medical bills or paying off accumulated medical debt. So it's no surprise to Representative Gottwald that those continue to be my concerns, but I, again, do want to thank him for including mental health and substance abuse last year, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Abderholden. At this point, we will move to our next testifier. In place of Stacey Weeks, we have Ron Elwood here. If you could introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony. And also, I just want to let members know we do have testimony from Stacey Weeks in our packet.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, Ron Elwood with Legal Aid, and I am a poor and far less better-looking substitute than the person who should be here, but she's sick today. And I want to thank Representative Gottwald, because I know Stacey had an opportunity to chat with him yesterday, and I think it was a very productive conversation. I know she came away pleased and grateful that for your conversation. And so with that, just feel it just necessary to put some concerns on the record today. You've heard most, if not all of them. Clearly, our major concern is about affordability and the ability of folks to actually get the insurance and about the coverage that they wind up potentially receiving. And, of course, about the deductibles and the copays, all barriers that are potential. And I appreciate Representative Gottwald's thinking about, you know, if this is a good idea, then we ought to make it bigger. I think the thought I'd like to put out there today is the issue with that is we don't know if it's a good idea yet. And I think that Representative Liebling's point to that point, and so if it isn't a good idea, as it turns out, or it needs to be tweaked and fixed, then what we've done is put 8,500 more people in a worse position than they were before. And I just would suggest to you that our public policy should simply not be to place low-income consumers in a worse posture than they otherwise be under the current programs. But we would also like to suggest to Representative Gottwald, as always, we'd love to continue to discuss the proposals with him, and we appreciate the opportunity that he gives us to communicate with him. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Elwood. And at this point, I'll ask if there's anyone else in the audience who wants to testify for or against this legislation. Okay, with that, we'll go back to our list of folks with questions. Representative Allen.
I just wanted to say make a comment about some of the comments regarding legislating responsibility It sort of reminds me. It's paternalistic. It reminds me of. I mean, I come from a place where the paternalistic is something where the federal government for Indian people legislated, controlled every single aspect, regulated every single aspect of our lives, and healthcare was one area. The Indian Health Service. And the number of experiments and policies and that were imposed, and most of them were talked, you know, in framed in language that you know, that we're trying to, well, first we're trying to civilize, but then we're trying to teach responsibility. We're, you know, we make them farmers, we make them. So it's disturbing to me that the legislation, it often gets, it, you know, we can look at the dollars it will save and how many, you know, if we can look at data as to, you know, we have a pilot program with a small number and, you know, what's happening there, but we're just going to expand that and without really knowing whether it's, you know, whether there's any sort of history here, whether it's working, and so that's offensive. The paternalistic, you know, that we're going to somehow make, you know, that people, if it's the privatization, that somehow that people are going to be more responsible.
Representative Gottwald.
Madam Chair, I need to respond to that. Representative Allen, I want to make it very clear that this bill's intent, regardless of what anyone else might have said about it, is to take us in exactly the opposite direction of the paternalistic situation you just described. This is meant to get people off of a one-size-fits-all, government tells you what's good for you approach, and give you the resources, or help you get the resources, to make your own choice. To go out on the market like everybody else is able to do and purchase the coverage that you think is appropriate for you. We can debate about the size of deductibles and whether or not those things improve health or hurt health. I think that's a very legitimate area of concern and discussion. But that is the primary philosophy behind this bill, is to move us away from the paternalistic government program approach to things to something that's much more freedom of choice for the person.
Representative Allen.
That would be correct if there was actually choice. I mean, if they actually had the environment or the means to have that choice, and but there really is, there is not that. I mean, to purchase health, private health insurance. I mean, if people working poor were in that position where they could do that, then it would truly be a choice. They would be determining their own, you know, taking control over their own lives and you know, at participating in a private and actually, but it's not, this is not the way to do it, there's no safety net, there's no way to if it doesn't work, the consequences are huge.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Gottwald. I appreciate this bill. And coming from a background of the working poor, there are times when they're talked about as if they're not smart enough to figure these things out or they're incapable. And I just kind of find that very concerning, that they are very capable. They are smart people. And with some help and some support and opportunities, they have that chance to do this. And by doing something like this bill, it puts them into exactly the private market where they want to be. They want to be there, and that this is helpful and constructive to them in a transition as they move from the working poor to being in a lot better financially sound footing. Well, maybe, because maybe if they get far enough along, we'll just tax them out of anything else they have left. Or that then they'll just be the rich people. No, I think the opportunity we have here is exactly that, for working poor to do the working better and to have those opportunities. And a bill like this gives them that opportunity to step into that with some government help on paying those premiums. And $10,000 as a cap on what they currently get in Minnesota Care and the underrate payments to providers is hardly a solution. I think that we can do better, and this bill helps us take a step in that direction. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll just be brief. We've talked about this piece of legislation for, I think, four sessions now. I don't think in any of the testimony I've ever heard about a survey of the enrollees of Minnesota Care asking to be transferred to a different plan. So while I understand people may have perspectives about that, I don't know that we have any evidence of that.
Representative Gottwald.
Well, in brief response, Representative Murphy, I think if you talked with some of the people who've had the experience of personal bankruptcies because they blew through the $10,000 inpatient, and I have talked with some of these people, the program was expanded. Originally, it was meant to be for people who, once they got through that $10,000, would go on medical assistance. But because the eligibility was expanded on the other end, we've ended up with people who, in fact, have enough resources that they blow through their $10,000 inpatient and end up with personal bankruptcy situations. We did hear testimony about that over the last 4 years. There are clearly people who are not happy with Minnesota care coverage and who, in fact, would much prefer to be able to choose something on the private market. And I would also point out briefly for the committee, you're talking about a subsidy of approximately $200 plus for an individual per month under this program, plus whatever they were paying under Minnesota Care, combined to go buy an individual policy for an individual person. And while deductibles may be available up to $4,000 or $5,000, you can in fact buy much lower deductibles that are much more reasonable and more consistent with the kind of needs these people have with that dollar amount. So I just want to make that clear for the record, because we have in fact had testimony to that in the past.
And Representative Murphy.
And Madam Chair, we've had, you know, certainly testimony, and we have conversations. We've all had conversations with people who are happy with, grateful for the ability to buy an affordable insurance product with their premium dollars that they're spending. One of the things we talked about last session was making this an option for people in Minnesota Care, so they could stay in Minnesota Care as we know it, or they could choose to take a subsidy and go out on the private marketplace and buy their insurance as you have described it here. And if this is really about the choice on the part of the individual to choose their own destiny, then we should consider that, and we can work on that, you know, between now and the Finance Committee. My suspicion is that the savings of this proposal will not be the same if we offer that choice. But if we're really about making sure consumers, Minnesotans, have the opportunity to choose, then we should consider that.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just like to say, I agree totally with Representative Murphy, and thanks for bringing that choice. And because people are smart, they can make decisions for themselves, so options are really good. But to help me understand the working poor and what that means, what is your definition of the working poor?
Representative Gottwald.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Moran, the typical definition is somebody who does have a job, is employed, but does not have the resources to do something like purchase their own private health insurance coverage. The goal of this bill, as I've pointed out many times, is to provide a subsidy from the state to help them afford that. So this is a working person who doesn't have the means to purchase the coverage that they need. That's my definition of working poor, and frankly, it's one that's been used pretty consistently with this group.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. Could you give me a dollar amount? I mean, what, in your opinion, because what I heard you talk about bankruptcy, and when I think of the working poor, I mean, bankruptcy is not one of the words we use for the working poor with my definition. So I'm just trying to get an idea of what you consider, and when you bring legislation like this to the floor to help support the working poor, what that dollar amount, what is that, $10,000, $30,000, $40,000? What is the working poor in your definition?
Representative Gottwald.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Moran, I'm not sure what you're trying to get me to say, but this bill is based on federal poverty guidelines. The 150% is roughly $17,000 a year for an individual. So it's not my opinion that matters here. It's what the bill is doing and for whom it's doing it. And the scale, and to your point earlier, the bankruptcies I'm talking about are the fact that we expanded under a Democrat leadership, expanded the eligibility for Minnesota Care on the upper end, so that people who might not qualify as working poor were having access to a program that was meant for people who really needed it more. That's where you start getting the personal bankruptcies. People who have means but will not qualify for medical assistance if they use up that $10,000 inpatient maximum. So it is, in fact, the people at the upper income range who are finding this not to be an adequate program. And that is primarily the people who we're focusing this change on, the people who we are going to give an assistance from the state to afford private insurance coverage. So,
Representative Moran.
So, okay, I'm trying to understand, get some clarity here. So this bill is going to work, help support those people in the upper level, not the one that's in the $17,000 bracket.
Madam Chair.
Representative Gottwald.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Representative Moran, it's down to $17,000 per year on the federal poverty guideline, and then upward from there to the top of the scale, which is 275% of federal poverty.
Representative Moran.
So, okay, thank you. So I guess I'm having difficulty with this bill because as we look to the private sector creating an opportunity for the working poor, and I've always known private sector, their goal is to make a profit, not to, you know, help others to be more self-sufficient and make choices. And maybe I'm wrong, you know, maybe it's not about private sectors making a profit and doing their best to support a state of people who is in that low income bracket and giving them the support they need. But I would like to say, I think it is about choice. How do we give people the option who cannot afford the private sector to still be able to have the insurance that they need for themselves and for their family, who are the working poor?
Madam Chair, I couldn't have said it better. I think that's exactly what this bill is about.
Representative McElfatrick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just like to make a comment. We have only briefly touched on advantage of being in private health care. I think we're all aware that physicians and other health care providers have the opportunity to refuse to take on new patients, which is limiting. And when we are providing through our publicly assisted health care programs, low reimbursement to our health care providers, we are creating a disincentive for them to take on our publicly assisted patients. Allowing people to be in private health care, we talked about this just very briefly, but allowing them to be in private health care insurance really gives them much better accessibility to the kind of treatment that they need. I'm thinking in terms of specialists and so forth. You know, I think that this is a real advantage for people to be part of a private health care plan. Thank you.
Okay, members, with that, Representative Gottwald renews his motion that House File 1986 be recommended to pass as amended and re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. Members, we do have a roll call. Is there any further discussion on the bill? Seeing none, the clerk will take the roll.
Gottwald.
Aye.
Mack.
Aye.
Abler.
Aye.
Allen.
No.
Barrett.
Yes.
Benson.
Yes.
Ramson.
Yes.
Fritz?
No.
Grunhagen?
Yes.
Hosh?
No.
Huntley?
No.
Kiffmeyer?
Aye.
Liebling?
No.
Nomer?
Aye.
McDonald?
Yes.
McElfatrick?
Yes.
Moran?
No.
Murphy?
Nope.
Norton? Peterson?
No.
Quam?
Members, there being 11 ayes and 8 nays, the motion does prevail and the bill as amended is adopted. With that, members, we will move on to our next bill, which is House File 2412. I do want to mention that with this bill, we do have several testifiers on the list. We have the option of continuing to work straight through or taking a break at our normal break time, taking a brief recess and coming back, to which we can allow the committee to decide at that point what we want to do. So with that, Representative Gottwald, to your bill, House File 1986.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members, I would also, in light of what's going on with the weather outside, and people's travel arrangements. I guess I would like to at least lobby my members, my colleagues on the committee to just continue with the committee meeting until we've worked our way through the testimony. But, of course, members can decide whether they want to take the break in between.
And Representative Gottwald, I just want to clarify, we're on House File 2412. Right. I misspoke.
So, Madam Chair, I will move House File 2412 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. And I'm very pleased. We had a great hearing about a week ago on transparency issues around managed care programs under the state and HMOs. And this is a nonpartisan issue, members, and really a bipartisan issue. We've had leadership from both sides of the aisle on this. I want to particularly recognize Representative Larry Hosh, who's up here with me, co-presenting this bill, and Representative Carolyn Wayne, who have also put forward bills. Larry, in particular, in the past, I'm sorry, I should call you Representative Hosh, but we've known each other a long time. He had a bill last year that we did not hear, but we took to heart, and a good number of the provisions that Representative Hosh was recommending made it into the special session legislation. They include things like withholds, administrative cost caps, new reporting requirements, new auditing requirements, a work group on health plan regulation and reporting requirements. All of those things are now part of state law, in large part because Representative Hosh provided leadership on that. Representative Lane brought forward a bill very much like my own, and we have combined our forces on this bill, again, seeing it as bipartisan and nonpartisan. And so they're going to help me present this bill, and I'm really pleased to be doing this. I think we need more of this, frankly, in the legislature. So with that, if you don't mind, Representative Lane, I'm going to turn it over to Representative Hosh first. I think he needs to get to his kids.
Okay, and Representative Gottwald, I just want to defer to you folks at the table. We do have a handful of amendments. Would you prefer to move forward with presentation and then go to the amendments, or get these amendments finished first?
Let's.
Okay, we'll go to Representative Hosh.
And Madam Chair, I want to thank you and the author of this bill for the opportunity to address the committee here. I do have to leave early. My wife is so smart that she left the state for the week and is in San Diego during our largest snowstorm, and I have to get home and pick up the kids from daycare. And it's a several-hour drive, so I need to try to beat the weather. But I do appreciate the opportunity to address the committee. Last year, I did author a bill that focused on some transparency issues with our HMO and PMAP plans. However, it wasn't just focused on transparency, but also outcomes. As a state, we want to maximize our dollars, make sure that we use them efficiently and targeted towards the populations we need to serve. But we should also have an expectation of good outcomes. And part of my bill focused on that. Additional withholds outside of what we used to do. We used to just do withholds on lead and early childhood screening. We've expanded that now. I want the committee to make sure that we focus on outcomes as we discuss this transparency issue. We always want to get behind the dollars in times of limited resources, but we also need to make sure that our quest for squeezing as many dollars out isn't at the expense of outcomes and performance. With that said, a lot of the things on my bill are excuse me, I'm going through puberty or something. So.
That will lead the news tonight.
Yes. So, much of what we're trying to pursue here also is an independent audit, but with also within an independent audit is to make sure that the actuaries, because one of the arguments that health plans always say is when we make cuts, we have to have actuarial soundness in our rates. Those actuaries need to be independent at the same time as the auditor, so I hope that we consider that. And then also, we probably remember last year, the large stack of reports that the health plans gave us. I was sympathetic to their plight and frustration that they may have a lot of reporting requirements that they have to submit and nobody reads them. We should take that to heart and make sure that what we do require for reporting to whether it be the regulators or legislative bodies, that they're clear, concise, and not duplicative. So to make sure that we have mechanisms in place that doesn't require legislative action, but some ability to make sure that there's not duplication in efforts towards our quest for transparency. With that said, I will let the testifiers and the authors of the bill get to the business, and I wish I could hear you guys on my radio on my drive home, but I guess I'll just have to listen to the archives and appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hash.
And I'll renew my thanks. I do appreciate Representative Hash's contribution to this issue. Representative Lane has also provided leadership on this, and I think what we'll do is ask Representative Lane to make some comments introductory, and then I think we'll look at the amendments one at a time. I know there are testifiers on each of them, I think, and then we can kind of pull our way through the bill, if that sounds good to you, Madam Chair.
That sounds good, Representative Lane.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My initial comment would be that this bill has two identical versions with a total of 19 co-authors, and I just need to say that it was initiated by me before session started, and the copy in the Senate and the copy here as 2412 were born out of the bill that I originated. So imitation is the highest form of flattery, and I value that, and I truly do appreciate the bipartisan nature of this. There's nothing wrong with the way it has come about at all. It's tough to make changes in this area, so it has to be bipartisan, and I appreciate that, and I thank Representative Gottwald for welcoming my participation here at the table. So as he said at the February 14th hearing, we listened for 3.5 hours to the discussion on transparency and accountability, and everyone said that it's no problem to have an independent third-party audit. So that's what this bill actually does. It fits in the statute on the prepaid health plans, the PMAP, and under the subdivision for managed care financial reporting. Now, that section has all the things that we're requiring the plans to report, but what we're adding to it is an independent third-party audit to make sure that we actually have clear and accurate data of those items that we are requiring. And it's just very normal in any business to ask for the information and then verify that information by audit. So that's what this is doing. It says that an audit firm that can't provide any services to or have any connections with those being audited, it says that the data shall be complete encounter and claims data at the source level. It says that all data necessary for the audit will be provided, no excuses. It says that the audit will certify the rates paid to the health plans. And it says that the audit shall determine compliance with the federal Medicaid rules. And then it adds that this request for doing a contract for an auditor will be done in such a way that we can be eligible for 50% Medicaid coverage for that. So if it's a $700,000 audit, it would cost the state $350,000. And I know that the Republicans always say that's all coming out of the same taxpayer's pocket, and that's true, but it does balance our book a little bit better if we can get 50% coverage. So that's the bill, and we can go through amendments. I have one.
Okay, Representative Gottwald.
Madam Chair, I also want to acknowledge that the Department of Human Services and the HMOs, the health plans, have been very cooperative in all this as well. I think the goal is the same. We need to get at transparency. We owe it to the taxpayers of Minnesota to know how dollars are being spent, and it falls to us to be the ones to enact policy around transparency. And so that's the reason this bill is before the committee. Madam Chair, I will move. Let's see. We've got the first one is the A3 amendment. Or maybe Representative Abler wants to move it, since I think it's his.
Representative Abler.
Oh, thank you. I can move it. I'll move the A3 amendment, Madam Chair.
Representative Abler moves the A3 amendment. To your amendment, Representative Abler.
Well, it's a way to make a process even better, right, and to take it out of the hands of anybody and to make it truly independent and without any disregard to any other of the other departments that are available to oversee this, be it the Department of Human Services, Health, Commerce, or MMB. I think if we just take it out of the whole realm of any governor's influence or anything and give it to an entity who's already charged with auditing, we have a state auditor, and not that the current one is gifted at health care work, but I think she's gifted and known for being pretty hard on people and, you know, kind of going after looking for truth, but then the RFP process could be conducted by that office. It'll swing partisan over the years to whichever to act to be both, I think. So, but I think it'd be a very fair site to do it. Then I think this would be something we all could rely on, and there'd be no undue influence by anybody. The legislature could not influence nobody else could influence this independence. So I would suggest that we assign this to the state auditor.
Any discussion to the A3 amendment? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Abler, do you have any, have you talked to the state auditor? Do you know this is something they could do or would be reasonable for them to do or anything like that?
Madam Chair.
Abler.
Actually, I've not had a chance to talk to her. I've looked at the Constitution, actually, to see if this was acceptable in the duty list. And the duties are assigned by statute. And so her duties include auditing cities. It's fully compatible with that as I read the law. And I would be surprised if they didn't want to take on this task. It's certainly a meritorious one and very important.
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess I would ask either Representative Lane or Representative Gottwald. I thought that the intention here was to have an independent third party, in part because special expertise might be needed to do this kind of an audit. And I don't know if you have thought, I guess I'd like to hear the authors, whether you've thought about whether the state auditor could do this in-house, or I thought the intent of the section, though, was that it would be contracted out.
Well, Representative Lane.
Yes, this isn't asking the state auditor to do the audit. It's asking the state auditor to get the contract for the audit. So it would remove it out of the departments that do the business and into a different area to actually engage the contract with an auditor.
Representative Gottwald.
Madam Chair and Representative Liebling, I actually see this as kind of a friendly and positive amendment. I think there is some concern about where this oversight occurs, and with no disrespect to the commissioner at all, the auditor's role is really to kind of oversee the functions of government from that kind of more independent position. And I think if we're trying to strengthen transparency, that might actually be a good place to do it.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. But what about the issue of the auditor? I take it you're okay with the amendment, but can the auditor do this? I mean, it seems like an odd thing to do without asking the auditor's opinion. I don't know if the auditor has anybody here.
Representative Abler.
Well, Madam Chair, and in thinking about this, and I did run it by about 10 people, not including herself. But I don't expect that her office has the capacity for this right now, but they would indeed contract for it. And the question in my mind, there's a number of people who, somebody sent an email, they're from town here and they want to do the audit. They're a forensic auditor and like, okay. But I want somebody who doesn't have a dog in the fight to pick the auditor. And so they put an RFP and they would, it'd be a $500,000 or $1 million project, I suppose. It'd be a significant amount of work. And then with her ordinary administrative capacity and her neutrality on this matter, then she would then have them do whatever the tasks are that we ordain for them. So that's the idea.
Representative Lane.
One more comment is that my understanding in the way the bill is written, it's very tight on who might across the nation be independent third-party auditor, and that she would just simply have to identify those handful of entities across the nation and ask them to contract into it or bid into it.
Members, any further discussion to the A3 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A3 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Members, will move to the A4 amendment.
Madam Chair, I am not going to be offering this amendment, and I'll explain why. We had talked with the department about this amendment, and if you look at the amendment, line 1.2, we are being asked to delete lines 7 through 12, which deletes the third-party audit, which, as Representative Lane and I have pointed out, is a key part of this transparency issue. I'd like to have a little bit more discussion with the department about this before we bring it forward. It may be that we can change this this amendment at some point, bring in their language, but I do think it would be bad for us to remove the request for the third-party audit. And so at this time, I am not going to offer the A4 amendment.
Okay, Representative Gottwald is withdrawing the A4 amendment. Representative Lame, I believe you have the A5 amendment.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Let's see. This, you know, the independent third-party audit is a high-level oversight, and as I thought further about this bill, I realized we need something a little bit more detailed. So this bill talks about the provider encounters and the provider payments, so we'd actually evaluate those, we'd actually have that data. So the Commissioner of Health would designate a private entity to receive electronically all encounter data and all claims payment information and set up a tracking system that can be used for ongoing analysis. We'd be able to analyze cost and quality and efficiency, and this data would also be used in the audit. And the amendment defines administrative costs and it defines medical costs. The data is private, non-public, and it also, this amendment also prevents a conflict of interest by stating that the private vendor shall not be a vendor for any of the health plans. So that's the amendment, and I think it just adds to the bill.
Madam Chair, I would move the amendment.
Representative Liebling moves the A5 amendment. And any discussion to the A5 amendment?
Madam Chair,
Representative Gottwald.
I just want to provide opportunity. I had understood there were some people who wanted to testify on this amendment, and so I think we need to offer them the opportunity before we move ahead on it.
Thank you, Representative Gottwald. Is there anyone here who would like to testify to the A5 amendment? Okay, if you could please introduce yourself for the record and who you represent.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Jim Golden. I'm the Deputy Assistant Commissioner for Healthcare at the Department of Human Services. Madam Chair and committee members, the department is opposed to this amendment, and we wanted to just provide you a little bit of information as to why. This amendment basically is requiring the construction of a system that is 100% duplicative of data that we are already collecting at the Department of Health. This would be an extremely expensive system to build. In all likelihood, the data that you collect through this system would be incomplete. And significantly inaccurate in relation to the data that we are collecting today. And even if this data were to be collected through this system, it would require some type of quality assurance program, as was in the A4 amendment, and would certainly require some level of audit that would be identical to what would otherwise be required. To help understand why this is the case, we currently collect all of the encounter data that is included in this, plus more data than this is requiring. A good example is this does not collect any pharmacy data for our Minnesota Care client, for our clients, period. This amendment does also not collect any of the Minnesota Care-related information. With regard to this, I think it's helpful to understand why this data is also likely to be highly inaccurate and incomplete. In the business that is there, the data that we are collecting is part of a natural business process between the healthcare provider and the healthcare payer. So the data that is being collected today, a healthcare provider submits a claim to the payer. They have quite a lot of interest in getting paid on that claim and keep an eye on what's happening with that. Likewise, the health plans have a strong interest in not paying any more than they absolutely need to and have an interest in keeping an eye on that claim. And so what we are actually collecting is what happens at the end of that. After the provider submits their claim to the health plan pays it, sends information back to the payer. That is at the point which we collect that data. At that point, both of the two sides have had a lot of interest in making sure that that claim has been adjudicated. What this is essentially doing is putting a third party that's in the middle that everyone sends data to, but no one really cares that it's 100% accurate. People aren't being paid on the data that's being sent there. Whether or not it's accurate, really neither side has much interest in. Our experience has been that those types of systems generally don't work. The other thing to help you just understand the expense of this and some of the potential challenges, the Department of Human Services collects about 25 million claims from our health plans and county-based purchasing. The system that this would build would continue to collect that. However, it would literally collect it from thousands of various providers. The likelihood that this could be combined up in a meaningful way are practically zero. The other thing that I would just say is that in addition to being duplicative of our existing system, it's very helpful to understand that our existing system is used for significant financial transactions. One of the things that we use our existing system for is the pharmacy rebates, which is a mechanism by which we collect pharmacy rebates from the federal government. That system is used to collect $80 million in rebates. With this data collection, it is very unclear how that would work. And then the final thing that I would just point out, one of the challenges associated with this is that as our data comes from the plans, we can be very prescriptive in ensuring that it's only the public program clients. Given the ID cards that are provided, this looks like the providers would need to submit all of their claims through the vendor that is proposed here, both their private sector as well as their public sector, because there would be no way to sort those out in advance, and this vendor would need to do that. That would raise the claims going into this system to about 60 to 65 million claims, and the substantial number, over half of those, would be pure private sector claims. So with that, I would be more than happy to address any questions about the amendment or our current system.
Representative Lane.
Thank you. Well, in simple words, I disagree. this is the department speaking about the encounter data that comes from the providers and the payment that goes from the health plans to the providers, and the department is already in the middle there. What we're saying is that the department, what we're looking for is a private entity to do the work that he is talking about through a software system that can track it very simply. It is not an expensive program. It wouldn't be duplicative because it would be additional to what has been going on in the past. We have all these things, as I mentioned in the other bill, that were information that we're supposed to be gathering for the PMAT programs, and in fact, they have not all been done. We've only just recently started to collect provider payment data. This is of concern because then we don't know. It's been called proprietary in the past, but in fact, we need to know this. We need to know what money goes out as well as what encounters are done. So it's a system that is incomplete at this time, and by doing it through this private entity that is able to do it through software, through an electronic form, is actually very cost effective. So duplicative, expensive, quality assurances, it is the data that all providers are sending in at this time. It is the identical same data. And it is the identical same data that is going out from the HMOs to the providers. It is not anything other than what is being discussed at this time, done at this time, partially. Pharmacy, Minnesota Care, it's supposed to be for all services provided by managed care and county purchasing plans to the medical assistance enrollees. So it's not to the private programs or to the public program. It's just to the medical assistant enrollees and to all services. If they're doing pharmacy, that's all services. So I don't agree with most of the things that have been said here. We'll see if there's anything else that I need to say.
Representative Murphy. Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess I need to know a little bit more about the data we collect now. So I'm wondering if we could go through in detail what encounter data is currently being kept, and so I could understand whether what we're trying to do here is duplicative or not.
Madam Chair and Representative Barrett, so the system that we have today. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Barrett, the system that we have today, a provider sends a claim into the health plan. Some of those claims go right through, they're fine. Some of those are sent back because they're not filled out properly or they have some issues that need to be there. Ultimately, those get resolved and that claim goes to the health plan for payment. At that point, the health plan adjudicates that claim pays that claim and creates something that is called a remittance advice, which is an explanation that goes back to the provider that describes how much they're being paid and what they're being paid for in relation to the claim that they submitted. Then all of that data, both the claim as well as the payment-related information, goes into a warehouse at the various health plans. What DHS does at that point is we have, as part of our contract with the health plans, is we require them to give us all of their claim and payment data from their system. The standard that we use is a national standard, and the reason it is a national standard is because it's widely recognized that the most efficient place to collect this data is at a post-adjudicated location because of just the sheer amount of issues that come up in processing across 12 different organizations, 25 million claims. And so when that data comes in, the very first thing that we do is an edit to say, we asked you to fill out this electronic format. Did you fill it out completely? Did you fill it out the way you were supposed to? If it fails that edit, it automatically goes back to the plan with an explanation of here's where it failed. Once it comes in to DHS, we run more specific edits on that. So for example, the types of edits would be things such as, is the date of service a date of service that's not in the past? Are we sure that it's not missing? We look to make sure that there isn't any procedures that were done on the wrong gender. So a man delivering a baby gets that sent back with an issue. And at that point, we stick that into our warehouse. In addition, the reason that I had raised the pharmacy issue is the way that the data comes in on pharmacy is a different transaction and a different format than the way it comes in on medical services. And the amendment doesn't address the mechanism to get pharmacy. So there's, in the way that the amendment is drafted, there would be no way for us to collect the pharmacy using the standards that are currently in this bill.
Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick follow-up. Obviously, we can go into every field on a particular record of a patient and to determine what is included and what isn't. Is there any fields that are just excluded from the encounter data that you collect? Maybe that's an easier question to ask than to ask you to answer what is included. Is there anything that you eliminate and don't receive?
Mr. Golden.
Madam Chair and Representative Barrett, no, there are none that we eliminate, and to the degree that there would be any fields that might be useful that we aren't otherwise collecting, we collect the data on a transaction that is essentially the same. It's a combined transaction that is the same as what the providers are submitting to the plan and what the plan is submitting back to the providers for their remittance advice. So to the degree that there are any of those fields, we collect all of those.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Abler.
Well, thanks. I haven't seen this amendment till now. I'm just trying to figure out what it really accomplishes, and I'm trying to reconcile Representative Lane's interest in Dr. Golden's explanation what they already do. And the best I can tell is that it's duplicative data, but there's a purpose in lines 118 to 125 of what it might be used for. And it just occurs to me that I don't think Representative Lane really wants to collect the same data twice. Maybe I don't know. But, that this could, if indeed we're trying to accomplish this review of the data stuff, nobody, to my view, has, in my experience, has questioned the data the commissioner has or that the plans have submitted as being incomplete or somehow dishonest. And so I don't know if you really need to collect it twice, but I think that it's not evaluated very thoroughly. And maybe if that's the heart of your amendment, we should, you can work on this. This is going to come to my committee sooner or later. I don't know where it goes next. But we're trying to, if this is that, I'm frustrated with how much data that warehouse has. Reminds me of Indiana Jones warehouse where they put that that Ark of the Covenant, and it's a lot of data in there, but it's not evaluated to benefit, and I've been working on that topic for some time. So I like the idea of your second paragraph here. We're trying to get some value out of it, and maybe you should work on this a bit and come up with a purpose of it. That'd be my thought, because I don't think I'm comfortable voting for collecting the data all over again, but I want to help get more value out of it. So that's my thoughts.
Representative Lane.
My one comment would be, you know, I hear about this warehouse, maybe even two warehouses out there, and yet we don't know, we can't provide the legislative oversight for the analysis of whether this program works better than that program, whether HMO is free for service, ACOs, how do we compare, because we need to know actually in calendar and payment details. But I refer back to that even though it says in statute that we will collect provider payment data, we haven't until just within the year. Is there more? What else? To have the this software that would take the provider encounter and the payment data and mesh them together so that we can do any sort of analysis we need to do would be wonderful.
Madam Chair.
Representative Abler.
And see, Dr. Gold wants to say something too, but I think the problem is we haven't told him to do it. And we haven't asked for specific outcomes of stuff. And I think that the heart of your amendment is really in the bottom part of the first page. That's my observation. And I'm friendly to your interest. So I'll leave it at that.
Mr. Golden.
Madam Chair and Representative Abler, I guess I would just have two quick comments. The first is I absolutely agree with you that data is what drives organizations today, and it makes by far the best informed decisions. And one of the things that we have committed to greatly at the Department of Human Services is to think about how do we use our data more effectively and more efficiently. And I would be glad to continue that conversation with you. We've had many over the years on that exact topic. You know, the other comment that I would say with regard to the paid amount, so the amount of dollars going from the plan to the provider and the allowed amount, it was, in fact, once that was put into statute that helped us facilitate collecting that, and it was a direct result of that going into statute that made that significantly easier to collect from the plans. And we did that as soon as it was in. We moved on that quite quickly.
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, I think we could go on with this for a long time. And I have to say I also am a little not sure here. And I'm the mover of the amendment. So I'm kind of looking to Representative Lane to see if, you know, this is going to Representative Abler's committee. And he's willing to continue to work on this. And seems to me that a lot of this is kind of a little bit of work that needs to be done offline more so that we can at least be sure we know what the point of disagreement is, if there still is one. So I guess I'm looking to Representative Lane to give me some direction here about whether I ought to right now withdraw the amendment and continue to work on it, and you can could always bring it forward in the next committee if that would be acceptable.
Representative Lane.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, because of the complexity of this, and as Representative Abler said, he had not seen it yet, it can use more eyes on it, and I would appreciate that. So with that promise in mind, we will do that.
So, Madam Chair, so I would withdraw the amendment.
Representative Liebling withdraws the A5 amendment. Ms. Brace, did you still want to testify at this point or to this amendment?
Yeah,
Ms. Brace.
Thank you. Twyla Bray, Citizens Council for Health Freedom. I do want to testify to this because this has been a key issue for us ever since the encounter level data went into law in 2008. And I would say that probably Mr. Golden might be right about duplication in this case. But just to say that I felt like Mr. Golden's testimony made you think, perhaps, that the only data that was collected was the data from the state public programs. But my understanding of the law is that unless you pay cash, data on every individual going through the paying with insurance is sent to the warehouse. And so when whoever asked about fields being excluded, the only fields being excluded, there aren't fields being excluded, there's a few that are being encrypted, but they're not encrypted to the extent that an individual can't be followed. So they do actually track individuals through this database everywhere that you go. And I think when you talk about the data and you talk about accuracy or not of the data, the hearing that you all had on the peer provider grouping showed that there can be data. There can be lots of data. But what does it mean, and how real and true are the assessments that are being made of that data? So we have been opposed to this collection for a long time and don't look forward to, I mean, would like to repeal it and don't look forward to having any other legislation that would put it further into statute or strengthen it. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Brace. Members, we'll move on to our next amendment, and just wanted to let everyone know, unless there's any strong disagreement, we're going to continue to work through in hopes that we can all be on our way in this weather sooner than later. Members, we have the A6 amendment. Who is offering the A6 amendment? Okay, members, we will move on at this point to the A7 amendment. Who do we have moving the A7 amendment? Representative Gottwald.
Madam Chair, did the A6 amendment was withdrawn? Or
no one claimed it at this point, Representative Gottwald. So the A7 amendment, who is offering the A7 amendment? Seeing no one. We will, that does it for amendments at this point. So with that, we have a handful of testifiers, and so we will move to those folks. First up, we have Dr. Robert Mikes, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. If you want to introduce yourself and who you represent for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bob Meeches. I'm the chief executive at the Minnesota Medical Association. I'm a physician trained in internal medicine and geriatrics and have a part-time practice in the Twin Cities. And I'm here on behalf of over 10,000 physicians and physicians in training to offer support for House File 2412. I will be brief because the time is short, but I do want to highlight our three primary reasons in support of the bill and then offer a suggestion to potentially strengthen the bill. First, the MMA supports the bill as a critical step in ensuring the state, policymakers, and DHS have accurate data and information. This is information, remember, that's used to make spending decisions of over $3 billion annually, and we believe the expenditures of this amount clearly warrant the heightened scrutiny and demand the assurances of accuracy, and so we support it for that reason. Secondly, the MMA supports the bill because it's going to help address some of the uncertainty and doubt that surrounds the current PMAP program. It will really help us with the clarity. And third, the MMA supports the bill because it would serve to codify beyond this administration some useful practices, such as an independent audit and the elimination of conflicts of interest that we understand are planned by DHS as outlined in the governor's March 2011 executive order. So for those three primary reasons, we offer support. But still, as many of you know, that the Medical Association has a long-standing interest in how managed care plans are spending state funds. And as an organization representing physicians, our primary interest is due to the lack of clarity about the adequacy and methods about how physicians and other health providers are being paid by PMAP plans. On the medical assistance fee-for-service side, not the PMAP side, but the fee-for-service side, physicians have not seen any across-the-board increases since 2000, and there have been numerous cuts in payments for non-primary care specialists over the few years. Prior to last year, the state had no ability to answer how physician services were being paid by the managed care plans for PMAP. Were they imposing similar cuts? Were they even? Were services even being paid adequately? A report issued last year by DHS offered some glimpse at the managed care payments for healthcare services, and in particular it showed that many of the plans were in fact linking their PMAP physician rates to the fee-for-service rates and that schedule. And although some plans are paying a few percentage points above this base rate, it does mean that if state fees remain flat or get cut in our hard financial times, the rates paid by managed care plans are also flat or cut. In face of that reality, physicians are obviously frustrated to see the operating margins and contributions to reserves experienced by managed care plans serving this same population. And therefore, we would offer that the bill should potentially be strengthened to address this point as well. And in particular, we'd like to suggest that any of the audits of the managed care financial data also include an assessment of the adequacy of payment rates in ensuring access to care and covering the operating costs of physicians and other health care providers. Appreciate the opportunity to testify and urge your support of the bill. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Dr. Meeches. Questions for the witness? Thanks. Ms. Hamilton, and maybe Representative Lane, if you can move over one notch there, we can get two chairs there and we can at least eliminate transit time. And Mr. Bartsch can come down and sit there. And I think if you can kind of, unless you have something that's really way new, if you can do about 2 minutes on your point. And if you like it, that's even easier. So welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Happy Nurse Day. I like your scarf.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Linda Hamilton. I'm the president of the Minnesota Nurses Association. We represent 20,000 nurses across Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Iowa. I'm here today on Nurses Day on the Hill to speak in support of Representative Gottwald's Bill House File 2412 and also Representative Lane's Bill House File 2214. As nurses, we are ethically and morally bound to our profession to advocate for our patients, and this includes access to health care. Representative Gottwald and Representative Lane's bill before you today does three important things. They require an independent third-party audit of the financing of PMAP, our prepaid health care program. The bills eliminate the possibility of an actuary working for the state simultaneously that certifies rates they may be consulting on. And finally, they require data explaining who received what kind of care, from what provider they received it, at what cost, to belong to the state. This will allow you, the legislators, in charge of program financing, to know the people eligible for care actually receive care, and what that care actually costs. If there is even one Minnesotan eligible for health care who is being denied care because billions of dollars, that's our tax dollars, are not going to care, then that's just one too many Minnesotan. Thank you, Representative Gottwald. Thank you, Representative Lane, for bringing these bills forward. The nurses here today and nurses across the Midwest urge you to support these bills. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Ms. Hamilton. Yeah. And then if Mr. Riemann wants to come and take a chair, welcome, Mr. Bartsch. Nice to see you. You have a handout. You brought two handouts to us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. While those are being handed out, if I can defer from the agenda for a second and answer a question that came up twice earlier today regarding prenatal benefits. Current law in Minnesota, 62A.047, requires that all individual and group insurance policy cover prenatal benefits without any cost sharing. But Representative Huntley is correct that maternity benefits do not carry that same requirement, particularly for some individual and small group policies. So just to clarify something earlier while that's being passed out.
Thank you. That's helpful.
Mr. Chairman, members, again, my name is Jeff Barsh. I represent Medica. I'm also here today on behalf of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. One of the items that's being passed out right now is a grid that highlights and describes the audits that the health plans currently undergo. And I'm not handing this out in any way to suggest that you shouldn't move forward with an additional or a new type of audit on the health plans. I'm just handing it out to help you hopefully answer affirmatively some questions as we've had this debate for about 5 years now. But the first question is the information that you're going to be gathering, either as a state or, more importantly, as lawmakers, is that information going to be better than information you're currently getting? Is the audit that's going to be produced under this legislation going to provide you with better and more accurate information than the information in the audits that are currently undertaking? And most importantly, is the information and the audit of that information that's going to be done going to answer your questions as the policymakers regarding the administration of these programs? And I hope we can answer yes to these questions, but that last one is really the most important. This has been a discussion, as I mentioned, for 5 years, and we've provided what we've needed to and been asked to provide to the state and to others. And we're here back again with an independent audit, which we don't oppose. But it's an important question for all of you as the lawmakers who are accountable to the taxpayers to make sure that if we move forward with this legislation or amend it somehow, that you can get the information that all of you need to actually say, yes, I believe that there is oversight, yes, we are accountable, and yes, I, as a lawmaker who oversaw this, believe and can defend that. And if we're not at that, I hope we're at that point, but I just raise that question so that if we're not, we can stop and make sure that we're answering those questions. Everyone here wants to make sure that these programs are being administered in a way that we can all feel comfortable with. And I just want to make sure that we're at that place, or that if we're not, we'll make sure that we are before we move forward. If we can't get to that place, then I would ask you all to consider whether or not we need to continue forcing the health plans to administer these programs. We're required by law to administer these programs under the rules that all of you in the Department of Human Services have set. And it's pretty clear after a number of years that not everyone's very happy with the rules and how they've played out. And I think we need to either agree that the rules are in place, we're all following them and we can all agree with them, or then we do need to really reconsider, should we move in a different direction? And should we remove that requirement and allow the marketplace to determine whether it's a health plan or a provider organization or whomever, work with the state to provide the most accountable and valuable program for these clients? I think we all share that goal. I hope we can answer those questions moving forward. That's what we'd like to see. Finally, Mr. Chairman, if I can just one more time, I appreciate the Medical Association's opportunity to be here and their support of transparency. I do think that as we move forward, we need to expand this conversation of transparency beyond just the HMOs and really include everyone in the healthcare system who deals with these programs, and that does include the providers. We currently don't know how much the providers are collecting from these programs versus their commercial programs, what their margins might be, and that doesn't allow us to answer some of the questions that were raised earlier, particularly some of the questions from Representative Grunhagen about what are we as commercial payers offsetting or subsidizing because of the underpayments of the Medicaid program. That is important information that I think this committee and others need to have as we move this conversation forward, and I'm looking forward to working with the author and others on getting that information so that you all as policymakers have a complete picture of the state's financing of these programs. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Bart. And I think that, I'll just let you go. You can leave before you get into a half-hour discussion on the questions you raised, but they're all valid. But I do hope personally, as this bill goes forward, that the authors, and they're quite capable, Representative Gottwalt and Representative Lane, and others, can look at the audit functions we do and see if indeed they could be consolidated in some way. I know when the MMB work got done, but I think 20-something reports were deemed to be extraneous. Mm-hmm. And so I think that we know we want something like what we're asking for today, but how does that fit into the whole plethora of other audits? So Representative Gottwalt.
Mr. Chair, just real briefly on that very point, I'll remind members of Representative Hosh's comments earlier on, and I think bipartisanly we've been trying to look at what, you know, I think in the past we've asked for reports or asked for a lot of data that gave us some sort of a comfort level that was maybe false. Now, we were asking for data, we weren't really using it for oversight. And I think our goal with this bill and whatever we do with it going forward is that whatever we put in place has to be meaningful. Whatever data we're asking for from the health plans needs to be something we actually use for oversight. We actually have to be able to mine the data to do that oversight. I think in the past we've asked for a pile of data and not really done enough with it. So I respect what Mr. Barsh said, and I appreciate your admonition to us to kind of work with people on that. But I think we want to get rid of extraneous reporting, as you put it, and focus on the stuff that really gets to real transparency.
Mr. McDonald, do you want to ask? Mr. Chairman, I did have a question regarding the bill.
Okay.
Do you want me to wait until after the testifier?
Well, we're actually doing testimony mostly, but if we're doing this is to the testifier.
I do not have a question to the testifier.
You're on the list. Welcome, Mr. Goodnow. You can come down. And welcome to the committee, Mr. Riemann.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, my name is Jim Ryman, and I'm here representing the Minnesota Medical Group Management Association. We are a professional association of more than 700 members representing medical practices across the state of Minnesota. We strongly support House File 2412 in that it will help bring transparency into the public program contracts between DHS and the health plans. These are the six things that we think are key on why we need this transparency. DHS has annually negotiated and awarded increases to health plans under PMAP and MinCare. Not once has any of these increases that the health plans have received been passed on to the providers who actually provide the care. Number two, since 1998, the health plans have received on an cumulative basis, and this is just looking at the PMPMs, 100% increase in payments. During these 13 years, providers not only lost on benefiting from any of these increases since we weren't getting these increases, but we were also getting substantial decreases, not only because the fee schedule went down through MA, but also the health plan reducing their overall reimbursement to us. In 2003, 2009, 2010, 2012. In response, number three, in response to questioning by the legislative auditor, DHS officials stated that they rarely collect information regarding health plan provider rates, the payment rates that we actually get paid, citing concerns about their ability to protect the data from public disclosure. I know that's changed in this recent year, but we still haven't seen any of these rates. DHS has continued to increase the administrative burden. We're asked to report obligations for the physicians for providing any of the care. As we go through this, we haven't seen any income care reports or utilization reports that actually show that patients are getting improved care during this time. So even though we're supplying the information, we're not seeing those outcomes. There's no debate that these requirements are adding cost to our administrative burden. Yet at the same time, our reimbursement is going down. Five, many published reports note that the health plan revenues from their public program contracts have exceeded even their commercial contract revenue and have been deposited into their reserves year after year rather than going to pay for patient care or reinvesting into the health care providers who can design a more cost-effective solution. Lastly, and finally, we want to point out that in October of 2003, DHS finished their negotiation with the health plans, and it was a two-year negotiation. At that time, the health plan sent us out a notice saying, hey, we had to take cuts here, so we're now going to do a 5% cut across the board to all your reimbursement. When we looked at that, we started questioning, hey, why did we even get into this in the first place? So a number of provider groups and members of MMGMA notified the health plan that we do no longer want to take PMAP through the health plan. We're willing to take MA, straight MA, but no longer through the health plan. In those meetings, when we went through this, and by the way, they notified us by a passive amendment. Didn't even send it certified or anything, but we received the notice. We're taking the 5% decrease. And what we were told by the health plans when we notified them we want to get out of this, if you don't accept this reduction, you'll be terminated not only out of PMAP, but also our commercial business. Now, faced with this, the unilateral decision being made by the health plan was reluctantly accepted by the provider community. Again, we're not trying to avoid serving the MA population, but this is what we are up against, is that the plan was telling us you're out of all of our contracts if you don't stay in our PMAP book of line, the business that we're doing right now. Since then, the health plans have continually decreased this. So in 2012, if you're a specialist in the state of Minnesota, you are now receiving 70% in 2012 of what you were receiving in 2003. Think about that. So I'm not talking about CPI increases that we're not getting. I'm just talking about the different reimbursement between two time periods. We believe a thorough, no-holds-barred audit of the contracts between DHS and the health plans is greatly needed. We urge you to consider making such a requirement a session priority. I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Yeah, and those topics are no strangers to ours, and but I appreciate your service to the clients that we all care so much about, and you understand the pressures. And
yes, I do. Thank you.
And every so often there's provider bills that pop up that will help some of these problems. So anyway, thank you.
All right. Thank you.
And if Mr. Prisbilla and Mr. Klein want to come down and take up some chairs, or they can come together. Mr. Goodnow, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Kevin Goodnow, and I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Chiropractic Association. I will keep my comments very short. The Minnesota Chiropractors Association supports House File 2412 and what the intent of the bill is, which is to improve accountability and transparency with the health plans that we contract with. I was going to leave it at that, but I, with some of the other testimony, I just wanted to make a point that I think the reason we're here and the need for the legislation is that we have lack of trust within the current system that we have. And that what this bill is and does and what we was really needed that, needs to come out of this bill is to increase the trust not only in between the provider and the health plans, but between the health plans and the state. Because right now there are inherent tensions between those three entities because of the payee system there, and there's always going to be those tensions. But right now there's such a low level of trust among the entities involved that we have to have a hearing like this and have to deal with it through legislation. And so I think if anything comes out of this hearing and out of this bill and the process going forward is that we need to increase the trust in our system. And in order to keep increase the trust, we need more accountability, and we need real reliability and transparency in the system. And if the current reports don't work, we need to find the reports that do. And that's the bottom line. So with that, I'd like to say we wholeheartedly support 2412. Thank you.
Well, thank you, and I appreciate that. The word trust, I think, is important in that. And for members who don't know, former Epson Goodnow and Commissioner, he's worn many hats in this place. And he knows a lot about that. So that's very well said. Thank you.
Thank you.
Gentlemen, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Are you together? Or are you?
Yeah, we're together. Sure.
You want whatever you like. And you brought us some stuff to look at, right? And you have handouts, right? These three handouts?
They should be coming around.
Okay. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, representatives. Good evening, good afternoon. I'm kind of lost track of time. My name is Jim Prisabilla. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of Prime West Health, headquartered in Alexandria, and serving 13 counties in the Minnesota public programs, health care programs. I'm here, though, to speak on behalf of the Minnesota Association of County Health Plans, which is an association of 43 counties, including both counties that are currently providing services to Minnesota health care programs, but also counties looking to get into the game of doing that as well, and serving low incomes. County-based purchasing, I want to be very clear, are not members of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. So when I hear the term health plans and us grouped with health plans and policies set by the health plans, we're our own group. Sometimes we're in agreement and sometimes we're in disagreement. On this particular bill, we're in agreement. We believe, well, I can at least speak, I shouldn't say the association instead of the council, but Prime West and the Association of County Health Plans support this bill, at least the intention of it. And that's because, frankly, for county-based purchasing, this is part and parcel of why we were created. It was really the concern of transparency and accountability with private plans that counties were concerned about contracting with the private plans to handle Minnesota health care programs. In essence, we would look at ourselves as kind of being uber transparent. We are, I think, what you aspire to have happen. Pretty much everything we do is publicly viewed. Our monthly financial reports, the data that you think you're missing in terms of what's being done is provided in our public, and providers are perfectly privy to that. Matter of fact, we're one of the few plans where you can actually call up the CEO and say, I see you had a good month last month. Why isn't my rate increasing? And members come forward as well. So it's really, I think what you're looking for to do is what we've arrived at several years ago. So I wanted to talk about that just real briefly, and that's one of the reasons we feel like we have a strong interest in the success of this particular bill or bills that support transparency. We're also proof positive that you can be transparent, publicly accountable, and still be successful in terms of operating Minnesota healthcare programs. We have a very close relationship with providers, and when they understand your fiscal and what you're doing financially, and they can see whether you've had to reduce rates or you could increase rates tied directly with the financials that they see, you have a better relationship with doing things together that better serve the participants in the programs. And I think that's what we're about here. We sometimes lose track of what are we really about in these debates. And we're really about serving the people who are participating in the programs. And it should be providers and plans working together. And that's been a premise of Prime West and county-based purchasing since day one. Therefore, transparency is key to the trust word I think I heard for the first time today, just a few minutes ago, which is the essence. I also heard from the MMGA that they talked about passive amendments to contracts. One of the things that county-based purchasing does not do is have such amendments. If we're going to change the rate with providers, it's mutually signed off upon, meaning that we can't say, here's a 5% reduction in your rate. It actually, we sit down with each administrator. We actually had to do that about 3 years ago after a catastrophic financial year to Prime West, and we sent out an amendment explaining RBC, explaining where we are at, explaining our rates, showing our financial statement, and all but one provider signed a reduction without debate, which was about 4,000 providers. So it's proof that if you do provide the evidence, show them, and they believe what they're seeing is credible, you can do things together and people are understanding. So I hope that's where we're heading with this. We believe there are issues within the bills that could be improved, and some of the areas could be strengthened. And one of those areas is cross-subsidization of public and private health insurance products and financial reporting. The bill currently proposed only audits the medical assistance finances. To really understand where the money goes, it would be important to look both at the public program finances and the commercial health care products. We know that's a sacred cow. We don't have anywhere in terms of county-based purchasing, if you look at us, and I think to a degree you care as well, you look at their finances, there's no place to go. It's public programs. So you see what we do. I think the issue comes is, where does the surplus go? Contribution to reserve? How about administrative spending? How does that allocate across commercial and public program? I think that's one of the issues this bill falls short on. Also is the excess profits and surpluses. People are very curious about, how do you set? What is your threshold? And when do you release and reinvest dollars after a certain amount? I think that is not properly addressed in this as well, because I think that's where it comes to the trust level. When will we see surplus dollars as providers put back to assure access to care for our members? We also believe one more thing, one more point, is that to audit in 1 year in isolation of previous years does not understand health care and the cycles. Prime West is coming off two pretty good years. Prior to that, Prime West was almost at 125% RBC, which is company action level, where Commerce steps in and starts calling you a lot and saying, what's going on? We have since built back, based on the last 2 years' performance, to about 450-500 RBC. And I know you're familiar with those terms. And at this point, we're looking to release or reinvest in our community. But that's only because we have to look at 3 or 4 years at a time and understand the cycles of healthcare. In that when you're particularly working in public programs, which is fairly non-diverse in terms of what you're doing, you're very vulnerable. And those are the things we would hope that the audit would understand as well, as taking multi-years rather than 1 year in isolation. And there's many other technical aspects, but that's where our CFO at Prime West can take over. I'll to John Klein.
Yeah, maybe 2 minutes if you can.
Okay.
I know that, and there has not been much county plan testimony, so I'd let you go on. It's very interesting. I could do this a long time, but it's pushing five and it's going to snow, and you know, we're loving the bill to death, which is pretty good. So, but I think Mr. Prisbilla, as it goes forward, I think you could offer some good technical advice to Representative Scott Waltz and Lane.
Welcome
and
that Ash.
But I also want to remind people what this bill doesn't do. We're trying to get to the point that there's math we can trust. That's really the issue. And what is admin really admin? And really, would you? Who are the sandwiches for? Like the auditor out of the you know, all the IRS and the shoebox, and I think that we get to that point, we can talk more about what reserves are appropriate, and that's a separate question and all that. So just to help people not make this bill more than what it is, we agree on this piece really universally, so I'm trying to keep that together. Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you. I'm John Klein. I'm CFO of Prime West. I'm also with certain health systems and consulting. I'll try to be very brief.
Just
on the subject of the audits, you know, as Jim said, we're all, you know, in favor of transparency. We'll come forward with some more specific suggestions, but we did note in the bill that there are three different types of audits that are called for. One is about our health plan's financial reporting. Is that accurate? That's kind of a CPA-oriented expertise. Another is about the actuarial work that supports DHS rate setting. And if that's performed properly, that would be more kind of an actuarial review, similar to what CMS, the federal government, does for Medicare bid audits. And then a third category is DHS itself. Is their health plan rate setting complying with federal requirements? And that would be yet another kind of expertise. So can maybe offer some suggestions. I'm not sure if there's one firm that could combine all of the types of reviews that are contemplated. Also, You know, we do have audits right now from an independent CPA, from the Minnesota Department of Commerce. The federal government has multiple audits, and so it was possible maybe to have some fewer audits to go with this additional audit or to consolidate or build on that in some fashion. We'd support that. And then finally, the Minnesota Association of County Health Plans has come forward in the past supporting streamlining. There was a report on that recently from MMB, which we're glad to see. We think it could still go further, however, in terms of recognizing more areas where there's overlapping with federal and state requirements, more recognition of data that is already available through the encounter reporting, and just more rigorous standards generally about do we really need this. I think they could have gone further than they did, and we can offer some specific suggestions.
And I hope the representatives next year are taking names of all of you to use as a resource. I would really, I think this could be, if it's the transparency piece, it could be also the audit streamlining bill, or at least a work group could go into place to come back with some suggestions if we can't decide it ourselves. But I really thank you for coming, and I know how much you know, and I appreciate you coming, and thanks for compacting it.
Thank you.
On deck is Dr. Perpich.
Yep,
and you're Mr. Robinson.
Yeah,
welcome to the
Dr. Perpich. I'm Dr. Michael Perpich. I'm
okay. Buddy Robinson.
Okay,
next. Sorry.
Oh, sorry.
Well,
sorry. No. And you've submitted testimony and like a packet, so
yes.
You can kind of outline what it is and in 2 minutes. And we have it. So thank you.
Right. My name is Buddy Robinson. I'm co-coordinator of the Greater Minnesota Healthcare Coalition, GMHCC for short. And also staff director of the Minnesota Citizens Federation Northeast. Our organization conducted original research over the past 5 years into the state's payments to the private HMOs for the public programs. We previously shared our results with the legislature and state administrations. Last June, we gave them to federal officials. The key points are in the handouts. I won't go over those unless you have questions. What we found is the following. Total profits from the public programs, including Minnesota Senior Health Options, MSHO, and also investment income for Blue Plus, Medica, Health Partners, and UCare, amounted to $755 million from 1995 through 2010. This amount exceeds by about $500 million the target margins built into the rates. The overall profit margin for this period is 3.4%. And in the case of Medica, at least, public program profits have been used to subsidize losses in their commercial products. In contrast, Julie Brunner of the Council of Plans asserts that the profit margin for the past 5 years was only 1.6%. What she did not state in her op-ed last week is that she arrived at that figure by excluding investment income from reserves and by excluding the very lucrative MSHO program. We applied a level of 400% of risk-based capital as a reasonable, adequate level of reserves and computed that these HMOs have about $500 million on unnecessary excess. Note that that roughly matches their excess profits from the public programs. We also note that the only external independent audit ever done on one of these companies was by the Minnesota AG's office. For 2000, the OAG found 18.7 was by the Minnesota AG's office. For 2000, the OAG found 18.7% in administrative expense for Medica, while the company had claimed 9.9%. And also note in the February 2008 OLA report, which our organization helped generate, states that the Commerce Department did not even bother to look at the plan's CPA auditor's work papers regarding administrative expenses, and that the auditors did not, quote, did not review the reasonableness of medical or administrative expenditures. In fact, some auditors cautioned that their examinations do not include a review of the plan's internal controls to identify errors and fraud. So these are reasons why external independent audits by firms which do not work at all for the insurance companies are very badly needed. Some things to look out for in auditing include whether the medical claims reported are the actual discounted reimbursement payments and not an inflated amount, whether medical expense and investment income are correctly allocated between public and commercial products, whether any rebates from drug companies are being hidden from view, and whether any investments are improperly put in the unadmitted category of financial reserves. And also, I do want to say that the county-based systems as public entities, as you heard, have completely open books, no trade secrets, they don't have huge reserves stockpiled from program profits, and they don't have CEO salaries of $1 million plus. You do not have any transparency or accountability problem with the public county systems, their problems only with the private HMOs. I know I gave a lot of material in the handouts. If you have any questions about those, I'd be happy to answer.
Oh, it's very productive, and there'll be discussion, I think, about reserves more as the session moves along, so thank you for that. Dr. Perpich and David, you can, Mr. Feinwachs, you can come down and trade places with Mr.
Great.
Robinson.
Thank you, Chairman.
Welcome to the committee. Hey, we'll try it again. Welcome.
Yeah, let's try it again. Everybody awake here? I'm Dr. Michael Perpich. I'm the practicing dentist in St. Louis Park in South St. Paul. I'm also the first vice president of the Minnesota Dental Association, which represents 77% of practicing dentists in Minnesota. And I'm here today to speak in favor of the bill, but I just wanted to give you what's happened in dentistry. Basically, dentistry, or access to dentistry, has gone away. Specifically, in southern Minnesota and Rochester area, the Main Street Dental has closed there for four clinic locations. That includes 27,000 patient lives. In Rochester, the Good Samaritan Clinic is closed. That's 2,000 patient lives. Mike Flynn in Lewiston has limited his practice so that he's now reduced his practice by 1,500 patient lives. As a wet-fingered dentist, I have the ability to see these people and the lives that they're having because they have no access to care. We're talking about the 800,000 people who are on care. Where are they going? Look in today's Star Tribune newspaper. They're going into the emergency room. And if you haven't figured it out yet, the cost of emergency care is between $750 to $800 versus a normal visit of $150 to $200. In addition, I know that people from Lewiston are going to the Smile Center in Savage, and people from Duluth and Dr. Huntley's area are going to the Smile Center in Deerwood. Deerwood to Duluth is 96 miles one way. That's where these people are going for care. And what I would like to know, everybody's talked about rate and payment verification, I'd like to talk about access verification. Because if you look at the CMS 1115 waiver, on page 30, item B, it says that the HMOs have to have a network. And in some of these areas in Minnesota, there is no network of dentists to take care of these people. Yet the HMOs still take the money and don't have any dentists to pay claims to. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, and I appreciate you bringing that to our attention again. It's worth hearing. Mr. Feinwachs, I'm going to give you 2 minutes, and then Dr. Joyce can come down.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Representative
Gottwald. You probably need 2 minutes, do you? But I'll give you the entire 2 minutes.
All right, thank you. My name is Dave Feinwachs. I reside in St. Paul. My views today are my own. I simply want to say, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Gottwald, Representative Lane, and all of you members, first and foremost, thank you. Thank you for the bipartisanship. Thank you for the leadership. Thank you for tackling an issue which is a difficult issue, an issue that gives people headaches. It's a tough issue. The learning curve is steep, and you've waded into it. By now, I'm sure you're all aware that this is not an issue that is unique to Minnesota. This is an issue which appears to be emerging nationally. Congress is aware of this issue. And Minnesota, as always, stands at the crossroads where we have an opportunity here to lead by example as opposed to being made an example of. And I think what you do here today, your leadership, continues what everybody expects from Minnesota, which is to lead by example. And so that's all I can say is thank you.
Minute and a half, thanks. Ms. Braze, you can come down. And welcome Dr. Joyce.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm here, too, to love the bill to death, I guess, and I'll be brief. I'm Dr. Michael Joyce. I'm a podiatric physician, and I represent the Minnesota Podiatric Medical Association. I'm a past president of the MPMA and currently serve on the board. I practiced podiatric medicine in Minnesota since 1989. Over many years in my private practice in Roseville, Minnesota, I have treated and continue to treat many patients who are on Medicaid. I feel there are some very serious problems with Medicaid reimbursement to podiatric physicians and surgeons. These problems exist not only for my practice, but for many podiatrists in the state. I believe that this is a crisis that needs to be addressed legislatively and that this bill is a start in the right direction. One podiatrist recently reported to our board that he received a reimbursement of $7 and, in another instance, $9 for the care of a patient on Medicaid. In just over a two-year period of time, I personally have seen Medicaid reimbursements from health plans for several procedures that I perform literally cut in half, while at the same time the legislature has greatly increased the amount of Medicaid funds that it gives the HMOs. I've also seen reimbursement for x-rays and other diagnostic tests decreased by 50% as well over a two-year period of time. Over the past year, I saw the overall number of clinic visits to my practice increase
while at the same time my reimbursements decreased by $30,000, while my expenses increased by $34,000. While this may not seem like a lot to a large group, I can assure you that a sole practitioner such as myself, this is a tremendous amount of revenue loss that is both unprecedented and ultimately unsustainable. With respect to Medicaid patients, I feel I'm providing services for free because of the cost of my time to perform the procedure and cost of staff assistance and overhead to process the paperwork for Medicaid reimbursement, it greatly exceeds the payment I receive. If a diagnostic test such as an x-ray in addition to the medical procedure is performed, the price I pay to see the patient is even greater. Throw in an interpreter and it becomes punitive. If the health plans have certified in their rates to the federal government over these many years that they have paid podiatrists more than they in fact have reimbursed us for, what does this legislation do to pay providers back for money that the plans may have unlawfully put in their pockets? What if the $7 payment to the podiatrist was actually certified at a rate of $86 and the HMOs pocketed the difference? How does this legislation rectify this? I commend you for this legislation that attempts to correct the problem going forward, but what about the years in the past? This past November, Commissioner Jessen testified to a joint hearing of the committee and the Finance Committee and stated, quote, "I am not in the business of keeping providers in business," end quote. However, I believe that the Department of Human Services and the legislature are legally and morally responsible for the integrity and viability of the Medicaid program, and paying providers less than the cost to see the patient is a serious problem that needs immediate attention. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Joyce, and I appreciate you coming down. Ms. Braze, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I have the honor of being the only one to oppose the bill. So let me just give you some... let me just give you some of my reasons. We definitely have a problem before us, and I recognize and perhaps know, as others do around here, you know, where the problem came from. But in case you don't recall, the 1992 Health Right Law brought the HMOs into the powerful position they have today. Essentially, the law collapsed the insurance market from more than 200 insurers into just three or four, depending on how you want to think about it. The legislation even made sure that no for-profit HMOs could operate here, and it forced doctors, dentists, and other practitioners to work for them through the Rule 101 provision. Now you depend on them, and we no longer have a true market. So what should you do? Initially, we liked the idea of the bill, except for the encounter data part, as we've already discussed. But now, after carefully reading the language and just looking at what it might mean, we're concerned. True accountability comes when consumers, and that includes the government, have the option to not choose one of these plans. Competition encourages good behavior because no one has to buy from someone they don't like. So further embedding government in private industry, albeit what's called a monopsony, is likely to bring us closer to single payer. We understand the concerns of the bill's supporters, but we believe this bill will meld health plans with government for control over all health insurance far into the future. Now, as you have heard throughout this discussion, there's been a lot of talk about the data. And the data is all about trying to get control. And that's what data is. It's about control. But governments that collect data on their people are big governments, not limited governments. And this is all about collecting health data and doctors and patients and violating the confidentiality between the patient and doctor, even if you can't see the name. The idea is to get in there and intrude on the practice of medicine. So in that vein, let me just share three specific concerns regarding the data. First, we don't support the encounter data law, as I've already discussed, and it's in there. And then second, making access to this data real-time, which is on line 3.8, could turn into real-time rationing as the federal government tries to add millions more to Medicaid through the federal law. And then third, the statement on 3.15 about unlimited government access to any and all data required is not the type of authority government should have over industry in a free society, although I can understand why you're tempted in this case. So what to do instead? We'd like to remove the not-for-profit HMO mandate. Everyone here has to be a not-for-profit or they can't operate in the state. We'd like to open the market to all types of insurance in and outside of Minnesota. We'd like to find contribution plans and vouchers for Medicaid. We'd like all the impediments to competition to be removed to make insurance more affordable. There are cheaper and less bureaucratic ways to care for the truly needy. It's not about covering everyone. It's about giving care to those who truly need it. I envision a future of real health insurance, not prepaid health care, of inexpensive catastrophic policies, of using charity, of medical sharing organizations, fraternal groups as in the past, free clinics, charity hospitals, which we used to have, and other options such as, in case you've never heard it, noinsurancesurgery.com. All of those should be available to compete for all 5 million Minnesotans. We believe this bill might get in the way of that kind of a future. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Actually, a lot of us agree with a lot of what you said, so, except a lot of us like this bill, but that's okay. Thank you for coming. Representative Gottwald, is anybody left who didn't testify that really has something they want to say? I don't want to leave anybody out. Representative Gottwald, do you want to have a... You want to react to something and briefly, and then it's 5:15, and a lot of us have had a really good day being here. But so,
I've got a half-hour speech prepared.
Well, then we'll move to the vote. Representative Lane, do you want to comment, and then Gottwald can close? And
yes, we'll that's good. I'll make one comment. I just like the use of the word trust, and I was disturbed actually to find it first mentioned by Mr. Bartz, representing both Medica and the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, and he used it in a sense as a threat because he said, either trust us or release us. That's a concern. Whereas Mr. Prisvilla of the county-based purchasing program said, trust works. Trust is the bottom line, and it comes from transparency. So transparency, our goal here is to be able to trust and to work together in a very effective and good way.
Thank you, Representative Gottlieb. One more questioner, and then I promised him he could. Representative McDonald?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a very short question, and I assure you it is not a pettifog. Question on Section 1 on the bill, Representative Gottwald. 3.27 down to 3.30, it states that the third-party audit may be eligible for federal subsidy for that purpose. So I'm just wondering, my knee-jerk reaction is that we don't want, or I wouldn't want, federal subsidy for a Minnesota state audit. However, since $2 billion comes from the federal government, perhaps it's warranted. So I'm just curious as to what number, if at all, we are eligible for.
Representative Gottwald.
Mr. Chair, I understand there's a potential for a half federal, half state funding under this, but you know, my general response to the question, Representative McDonald, is if people have things they think they'd like to change or improve about this bill, I think Representative Blaine and I and Representative Hosh, who's not here right now, but I think we're willing to work with people to make this better. I think you've heard that from the current acting chair. We've heard a lot of testimony today. I don't see it as a conflict between county-based purchasing plans or county health plans and private providers. In my mind, this bill is about transparency and about getting at where the dollars are going. When they come out of a taxpayer's back pocket, we have a responsibility to track those dollars from our back pocket to where they delivered some good or service for the people of Minnesota. The things that we intend them to do. That's our responsibility. And so that's any data that can help us get at that. I know there was a mention of total access to all data a moment ago. It's only for the purposes of the audits. But again, if there are ways we can improve this language to meet concerns of various people, we're glad to do that. But again, that is the goal of this bill, and that we not do it in a way that's just window dressing, but that we do it in a way that actually gets at transparency. You know, so we didn't. Well, we asked for 20 reports, so there must be transparency. No, we asked for 4 reports that get at exactly the data we need to know where the dollars went and what services they delivered and those sorts of things. So, the three of us have started this, and I think all of us are going to contribute to it. And I look forward to the next step.
There's actually one more. Representative Barrett, did you want to add something?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, I just wanted to echo the thoughts of Representative Lane earlier when she was talking about Mr. Bartz, and I kind of had the same feeling you did about what I heard. Fact is, this is a big issue, as a big deal, as I think our vice president said one time about a separate issue. And it's being heard around the country, and even our representatives and our senators are being involved. I'm in receipt of a letter here from Charles Grassley from Iowa, and it's a letter he sent to two states in our country, Arizona being one, Minnesota being another, in which he asked for a lot of questions about this issue of HMOs and auditing accountability. And so what I want to do, the department I don't think is here to answer it, or maybe they are, but I wanted this in record, and I'd like to know if the answers to this letter that Charles Grassley had asked of our department, if we could also have the information be sent to us as a HHS policy committee.
I think that they would be happy to respond to that letter, and we could pick that up as a receipt of information.
Very
good.
Just
to be fair, does anybody over here want to ask a question? This time. Okay. Okay, actually, we're going to vote on who gets to talk. If anybody gets to talk anymore, we're going to have to get 60% to get a chance to ask a question. Go ahead, Representative. Just a joke. Representative Lane, what would you like?
Thank you. I just wanted to say that my understanding is that that letter is actually sent to all 50 states.
Mm-hmm. And I think the department will give us a written response.
Very good. Yeah, Mr. Chair, I saw nodding heads over there, so I think in the interest of transparency on that issue, I'm sure we're willing to share that information and get it on behalf of the committee if necessary.
Sure, I stand corrected then, Mr. Chair, about the two states, but my main point is it would be nice to have the information when it's available.
Seeing no further discussion, Representative Gottwald renews his motion that House file, whatever this one is, 2412?
2412, Mr. Chair.
Oh, it says Huntley. be renewed and be referred to the Human Services Finance, as amended. Thank you. All in favor of that, say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. The bill is referred. Any more business to do? A little longer? We're adjourned. Bye. Drive safe.